10. Star, how do you sleep at night? The perfect tool of the radical right. You think it's over now, we indict you for the death of democracy. By a powerful few. Independent counsel, independent of who? It sounds pretty good, if only true. In the pocket of scoundrels with blood on their hands, who drain all the oil from everyone's lands. And as our country goes down the drain, don't think that we won't remember your name. We'll be pointing at you with our last dying breath, 'cause you set the stage for democracy's death.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Lucasfilm employees are hoping the Force is with them. Nearly 500 computer graphic workers at Industrial Light and Magic are losing faith that talks will be completed before their contracts expire on December 31st. Represented by the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, workers' discussions over the contract are being held up by healthcare and wages. Most employees earn between $25 and $50 per hour, but live in California's expensive Marin County. Layoffs are another issue. Many film studios lay off employees after production is completed, and the union wants Lucasfilm to give workers the opportunity to learn to use new software so they can compete in the computer graphics market. In 2002, the AFL-CIO gave George Lucas, founder of Lucasfilm, an award for his commitment to collective bargaining.
The National Hockey League rejected a players' union contract offer this week, continuing their nearly three-month-long lockout. Up 14% from September, the union's latest proposal includes a 24% cutback in salaries for the 2004-05 season. The NHL is seeking salary caps or cost certainty. The league is expected to issue a counterproposal today.
Workers at a New York Times printing plant are raising allegations that they have been subjected to racial and religious discrimination. The lawsuit was filed by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission for workers at the paper's Addison, New Jersey plant. The lawsuit says that Hispanic, Black, and Jewish employees were denied overtime assignments, seniority rights, and promotions. They also claim that supervisors at the plant used derogatory racial and religious terms. The suit claims that the Times has long been aware of the incidents, but has done nothing to correct the behavior. The New York Times management has declined to answer reporters' questions concerning the incidents.
The state of Missouri's rapid response team is meeting with some of the 900 Ford workers facing layoff early next year at Ford's St. Louis plant. The plant's second shift is being eliminated. The rapid response team tries to help workers get transfers, new jobs, or training for new careers. These services are provided to the Ford workers free of charge. Missouri's governor worked with Ford to try and keep work at the St. Louis plant, but the second shift will be eliminated nonetheless.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Next time you drop your kid off at daycare, be sure to thank the child care workers. A new study by the Working for America Institute says that the median wage of child care workers in the U.S. is only $7.90 an hour, compared with an average of $13.53 an hour for all other jobs. Low pay, lack of benefits, and little room for advancement are causes of high turnover in the daycare industry. The study states that employers must provide workers with better wages and training for the quality of the daycare system to improve.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find Amoeba online at amiba.net.
When is an election over? When the votes are counted, right? Thus, Republican Dino Rossi says he's the new governor of Washington State. Not only were the votes counted, but also recounted by electronic machines, and Dino promptly declared himself the victor by a whopping margin of 42 votes. Yes, 42 votes out of 2.8 million votes cast on November 2nd, the tiniest margin of any gubernatorial election in U.S. history. Still, Rossi proclaimed himself governor-elect, had a victory party, and departed for a 7-day Caribbean cruise. But wait, says the Democratic candidate, Christine Gregoire, the vote is not over until every vote is counted and counted accurately. Democracy demands no less than that for elections to be legitimate, and in the Washington State case, that accuracy is very much in question. Counties report that some of their electronic recounts don't match the number of physical ballots, that they have had computer glitches, that some precincts were double counted, etc. So Gregoire is calling for a hand count of all 2.8 million votes as the only way the vote can be truly verified, and her supporters have raised the money to pay for it. Oh no, wails Rossi, we can't have this. Now back from the Caribbean, he says that he's tanned, rested, and ready. He's already been picking out new drapes and carpet for the governor's office, so he and his partisans have demanded that Gregoire be a good sport and go away. Go away? What about the right of all voters to trust that their ballots were counted as cast? The 42-vote margin is 0.0014% of the total vote, well within the margin of error for computerized counting machines. Sure, a hand count will take a few more weeks, but what's that compared to getting a governor who's actually legitimate? This is Jim Hightower saying, it's time for all of us to take a stand somewhere for the integrity of our vote. To do it in Washington State, call 206-328-2969.
The notion of a 40-hour work week is several hours short of reality. Working long hours is a given when you run your own business. That's why Sam's Club carries products to help make that easier. You can count on Sam's Club to have just what you need. Bounty paper towels, Charmin bath tissue, Puffs tissues, and other quality brands, all at everyday low costs. After all, we know that time and money are important to you. Helping you make the most of both is why we're here. Sam's Club. We are in business for small business.
One in four adults has high blood pressure. If you're one of them and you have a cold, Coricidin HBP has surprising news for you. The American Heart Association recognizes that decongestants found in many leading cold medicines can raise your blood pressure and interfere with blood pressure medication. So why risk it? Only decongestant-free Coricidin HBP provides a line of safe, powerful cold and flu medication specially formulated for people with high blood pressure. So make the safe choice. Coricidin HBP. Use as directed.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live, coast to coast, on radio stations from California to North Carolina, streaming down from the Sirius, from the depths of outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, with archives at whiterosesociety.org. As well as at TomHartman.com, where you can also drop into our chat room. However you spell it, it'll get you there. TomHartman.com. Just click Live Chat. It'll bring you over to the Democratic Forum on CompuServe. You can sign in, log in, or come in as a guest and drop in and say hi to some of the finest folks in the whole entire Internet. Today, at the bottom of this first hour, we're going to be speaking with Mike Jeffries, who says we must return to biblical values here in the United States. And so, therefore, I'm going to be asking him, when do I get my four wives? Louise, put that down. No. Okay. All right. Maybe I won't ask him. Well, we'll see. Is Michael Powell becoming the preacher in the movie Footloose? Michael Powell of the FCC. What's going on with this guy? It's going to be an interesting day. In the second hour of our program, we're going to have a chimp alert. Yeah, sure enough, you didn't. We're going to have a chimp alert. Our NLP lesson, the second half hour of our program. A different way to look at goals and goal setting. I guarantee You've never set goals this way. We're going to be looking at how we're messing up the vote as well, not just here, but in Iraq. And finally, in our third hour, how the Bush administration is flushing the economy down the drain. This could be connected to the 777,000. Gee, that's kind of a biblical number right out of Revelations, isn't it? Anyhow, the seven, it's actually 144,000, but then there's a seven. The Masons would have appreciated it. The 777,000 people just in Los Angeles County who are experiencing what the newspapers euphemistically call food shortages. Nobody wants to say we have starvation or hunger or famine in the United States. No, it's food shortages. Hunger challenge. They are hunger challenged. The new political correctness. 544 days since Joe Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, was outed. And Bob Novak is still free, running around, writing his, how do you characterize that without name calling? Writing his stuff. You know what I'm talking about. Why is Bob Novak not in jail? I just don't. Anyhow, 771 days since the weapons of mass destruction search began. I have not seen an official notice that we've called it off. There's still, even the cons are still saying, well, maybe one of these days we'll find one someplace. I'm not sure where, but maybe over here.
Well, you think we'll find one there, Ralph? I don't know. Maybe over here.
Time will tell. 844 days since the anthrax killer struck. Did you hear John Ashcroft talk about that in his farewell address in which he claimed victory on all fronts? I didn't. I suspect you didn't either. 1,198 days since 9/11 and 42 days into the second term of corporate rule in America. A form of government named by Benito Mussolini as fascism, the merger of corporate and state interests. Taken together, Bob Petrakis writes in the Columbus, Ohio Free Press, along with Steve Rosenfeld and Harvey Wasserman. Taken together, Bob was one of the folks who testified yesterday in Ohio before John Conyers' group. You remember Congressman John Conyers? He was on this program, I think it was 2 weeks ago, as I recall, a week and a half ago, thereabouts. And he moved his hearings to Ohio and took testimony and And it wasn't on C-SPAN. And it wasn't mentioned in the New York Times. I'm telling you, this is, if you do nothing else today, go to the NewYorkTimes.com, NYTimes.com website, and find the, how to respond to us page. And send an email to one of the senior editors there going, why are you not covering Congressman John Conyers' hearings about vote fraud in Ohio? Why are you not covering the story of vote fraud in Ohio? Or call the New York Times offices in New York City. You can dial 212-INFORMATION. Most of America now, you just dial 411 or whatever, and you get in. Here, when I dial 411... Here in the People's Republic of Vermont, I get an operator in India who will tell me the phone number for the New York Times. So anyhow, get their phone number and call them up and say, why aren't you covering this thing, guys? This was not in the news yesterday, in the paper of record. Here we have a situation. Setting aside whether Bush won or lost or Kerry won or lost. Let's just assume that that Bush won. I mean, 3.5 million votes more than Kerry. If he really got all those votes and the voting machines didn't lie to us and the thing wasn't hacked, which in my mind is an if, and that's the problem. I mean, of course, as long as we have a system where there's an if, we have a problem, right? As long as there shouldn't be an if. That's the bottom line. It should be just, very straightforward. Should be no doubts. But anyhow, as long as we have this if. But setting that aside, let's just give it. Still, if there was vote fraud going on in Ohio, or anywhere else in the United States. We need to know about it, because if it can be done by Republicans, it can be done by Democrats just as well. All of us should be worried about this. I mean, this goes way beyond political partisan stuff. So here's a bunch of things. In Warren County, where election officials declared a Homeland Security emergency on Election Day, barred reporters and so on. They prepared for the Election Day lockdown. This disclosure suggests the lockdown was a political decision, not a true security risk. What was going on? In Franklin County, Ohio, where Columbus is located, the election director, Matt Damschroeder, misinformed a federal court on Election Day when he testified the county had no additional voting machines. Turns out they had 81 of them being held back. So that in the Democratic districts, you would have long lines. People would give up and go away. In Franklin County, a worker at the Holiday Inn observed a team of 25 people who called themselves the Texas Strike Force using payphones to make intimidating calls to likely voters. They paid their way to Ohio, but their hotel accommodations were paid for by the Ohio Republican Party, whose headquarters is across the street. Work in the phone bank at the Holiday Inn. Hotel worker heard one caller threaten a likely voter with being reported to the FBI and returning to jail if he voted. One hotel worker called the police, but the police did nothing. Apparently, it's not illegal to call up and intimidate voters in Franklin County, Ohio. In Knox County, students at Kenyon College Liberal Arts School stood in line for up to 11 hours because only one voting machine was in use. However, at nearby Mount Vernon Nazarene University, the Christian college, expected to go heavily for Bush, there were ample voting machines and no lines. Reports and sworn affidavits affirm numerous instances of direct official interference with the right to vote. In Warren County, Democrats were being targeted and forced to use provisional ballots even if they had proper ID. These ballots were then subjected to more rigorous standards to be counted than other ballots. 155,000 of them, by the way, were thrown out. In a half dozen precincts in Franklin County, people who were not inside polling places by 7:30 p.m. were told to leave even if they had waited in line for hours. This is a violation of the Voting Rights Act. In one exit poll affidavit, Jonathan David Simon, an expert witness, notes that at 12:53 a.m., the exit polls altered the projected winner, even though the same number of votes had been cast. You know, what's up? What's going on? For instance, 16 precincts in Ohio, they were found votes had been shifted from Kerry to other candidates. In at least 30 precincts, there was ultra-low voter turnout. These were precincts where Kerry was expected to carry. Voter turnout as low as 7.1 to 13.05%. Only 7.1% of registered voters, according to the official results, in some of these heavy, heavy Kerry districts, actually showed up. To be absolutely accurate, the way to say it is only 7.1% of the registered voters had their votes counted. Whereas in most districts, the average voter turnout was between 60 and 83%. So, you know, what's going on here? And now you've got Ken Blackwell, the co-chairman of the Bush for President campaign and the Secretary of State in charge of the elections, locking down election records and saying, sorry, you can't inspect those things anymore. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, by the way, our website, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our chat room. And let's talk to John in Flint, Michigan. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hi, sorry, today.
Hey, John, you're breaking up a bit there. I'm sorry, John, your cell phone's really crummy. I'm going to put you on hold. And I'll take your call again. We'll try it again in a minute or so, see if you can get into a little better spot, or maybe you'll want to call back a little bit later on. Anyhow, we've got to figure this thing out. We've got this has to be cleaned up, and the election problem. This is not. I mean, of course, you know I have partisan preferences, but if this was being done in a state that the Democrats controlled, and they were manipulating the vote to make it look like John Kerry had won when, in fact, George W. Bush had won, I would be equally outraged. My first loyalty is to democracy in the United States, not to any particular party. I'm not even a member of any particular party. I have problems with the Democratic Party just like I did the Republican Party. You know, this is not about partisan politics. Let's see if we can hear John again. Hey, John, is that thing working now?
Yeah, I'm still here, Tom.
Okay, great. What'd you want to say, John?
I just wanted to say I did watch Conyers on C-SPAN, and I do believe it was Wednesday or Thursday last week.
Yeah.
I sat there squirming in my chair as he's trying to control these meetings. And, I mean, the senator, Jesse Jackson was there and some other senators.
Yeah, I saw it, too.
It just kind of made me squirm watching these Democrats trying to deal with this problem. And I have no hope in it at all.
And you know, they had invited all the Republicans who are members of that same committee to show up, and not a single one would show up.
Yeah, that's
didn't even want to listen. Didn't want to know what was going on. And you would think that Republicans would be just as concerned about the future of democracy and the sanctity of the vote in a democracy, as would Democrats.
It's almost like the Republicans have the Democrats in between the rage of the American people, because if something like this were to get out of hand, I mean, it sent a lot of things overboard, and it's all in the cost of keeping the peace.
Well, it could be, John. It could be. I think it goes beyond that, and that's where it starts getting ugly and getting into conspiracy theory and whatnot. But I'm concerned. I'm really concerned about the future of democracy in America. 20 minutes past the hour. I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
If you sell a product or service, we have listeners from coast to coast and in 97 countries who want to know about you. Reach out to our national audience with our small business advertising package. You'll pay just a fraction of what national advertising usually costs. Call now at 802-229-2288 or visit our website, tomhartman.com, and follow the links to the small business advertising package for more information. Don't miss reaching a national audience now. 802-229-2288. Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
The following phone call was not recorded on February 30th, 2004.
Thank you for calling about DirecTV. My name is Lynn. How can I help you?
Thank you, sir. Thank goodness you're there. You've got to help me. My cable company is raising their rates again. I don't know what I'm going to do.
It's okay, ma'am. I'm here to help. I'm glad you called.
They're taking away our favorite channels and charging more. It's just wrong.
Ma'am, I get that all the time. Let me help you right away. Would you like to get over 125 channels of your favorite programming for only $39.99?
Will I still be able to get my local channel? Satellite?
Absolutely. And because you called American Satellite right now, you can get up to a four-room DirecTV system for free and free professional installation for all new customers with an annual programming commitment.
Oh, thank you. My husband, Nick, is going to be so happy.
Call American Satellite at 1-800-505-1542. That's 800-505-1542. Call now and ask how you can get total choice for only $29.99 a month for the first 6 months. A $60 value. 800-505-1542. At $4.99 a month for second and each additional receiver. Offer ends July 17, 2004. Call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We ain't asking you to love us. You may place yourself high above us. Mr. President, pity on the working man.
Yeah, Mr. President, think about the working man. It ain't going to happen. Mr. President has never been a working man. And, we don't need to go there. Enough of that. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here back with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Willie in Georgia is on the line. Hey, Willie, what's on your mind today? Welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing today?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up, Willie?
I got three quick comments real quick.
Sure.
Well, I believe that I appreciate what you're doing in Ohio with the voting and everything, but until we get a national figure to actually take this thing up and say, oh, look, you know, like a Clinton or somebody really powerful that the country itself looks upon with a lot of respect, not too much is going to get moved.
I suspect you're right. I think, though, that Jesse Jackson, John Conyers, and some of the other members of Congress who were there, that, in my mind, any of them should have tipped it over the edge. And the fact that they haven't speaks to, in my opinion, frankly, I don't know if it's racism or if it's the discounting of all things democratic, or maybe it's a little bit of both, but that's going on in the media in this country. But
the
I just find
thing I wanted to get, which I was listening to you today when you were covering for Randy Rhodes.
Yeah.
And you had a caller that, you know, he didn't want the government to back him up as far as, you know, Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't believe that the government should help us or whatever. And I'm thinking, you know, with Social Security, everybody just zones in on that paycheck and retirement.
Right.
But I believe it's true that our taxes also pay for our fire departments, our police departments, our garbage disposal. So if you don't want the government to back you up, then put your own fire hydrant in front of your house, build your own jailhouse. I mean, if you don't want to back them up in one area, then just kill it all.
There you go.
Social Security covers everything.
Yeah, well, yes and no. The social, your point is absolutely right, and I totally agree with you, Willie. There is this thing called the commons. You know, collectively, we in the United States, we all fund this stuff together, the police, the fire, all these other things. We do it with different ways. In most communities, the police departments, the fire departments and whatnot are paid for out of property taxes, or they're paid out of local state income taxes, usually property
right.
taxes, though. The FICA tax, the payroll tax, is specifically, and I believe, I may be wrong, but I believe that it's specifically for Social Security and Medicare. And
okay.
and it basically funds those things. And that's why even if you're exempt from income tax because your income is so low, say somebody only makes $5,000-$10,000 a year, they don't have to pay income tax. And that's, you know, Rush Limbaugh will tell you all day long, oh, these people pay no income tax. They're still paying FICA. They're still paying a payroll tax.
It still comes out of my pocket as far as property tax and everything else.
So there
I
you
pay
go.
My government to help me out.
There you go. That's the bottom line. Yep.
My last thing, and I'm going to let you go, I have a nephew that's ADD.
Uh-huh.
What book would you tell me to get as far as what you wrote for somebody who has no idea what this is?
Okay, the best book that I've written that's like a starting book on that is a book called Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. ADD, A Different Perception. It's actually the first book I wrote. I wrote it about 7-8 years ago. We've updated it was 10 years ago. We've updated it, though, and it's out there. It's probably the best-selling, actually, of all my ADD books. And it's the book in which I lay out the idea of a hunter in the farmer's world, that these kids are not defective. There's nothing wrong with them. We need to be fixing our schools rather than our kids, as it were. And it has, you know, specific tips and parenting tips and things. But mostly it's about helping give them back their self-esteem and give parents back hope that things can go well for them. Willie,
okay.
Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you.
Have a good day.
You too. And Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, Happy Hanukkah, whatever's appropriate. Tony in Washington, D.C. Hey, Tony, we've got about a half a minute left. What's on your mind?
You fucking asked on the other side.
Why didn't the Democratic Party, I don't know if you didn't, did they talk about verifiable voting? And what do you think about Giuliani and a McCain presidency candidacy?
I think Giuliani's got enough skeletons in his closet that he probably won't go beyond the possibility of running for the United States Senate against Hillary Clinton, frankly. I don't think he's a national candidate. As far as the Democratic Party talking about verified voting, they're not. And I think it's a crime. And we need to be leaning on them. We just absolutely need to be leaning on them.
Okay.
And making lots and lots of noise. And hopefully John Conyers is doing that. I think he's kicking through some doors here. He's breaking up the ice or whatever the metaphor is. People are starting to wake up. Tony, thanks for the call. It's always wonderful to hear from you. Good to know that you're still listening there in Washington, D.C. 29 minutes past the hour. In just a minute, we're going to have Mike Jeffries going to tell us all about why I can have four wives.
Mom, I can't believe you asked Rick all those questions. Where do you live? And who are your parents? It's so embarrassing.
Getting to know your kid's friends isn't easy. But if you don't, he's more likely to do drugs.
Geez, you have to know everything?
Actually, Sean, I do. Do it. It'll always be worth it. Parents, the anti-drug. To learn more, call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com. Sponsored by the ONDCP and the Partnership for Drug-Free America.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Lucasfilm employees are hoping the force is with them. Nearly 500 computer graphic workers at Industrial Light and Magic are losing faith that talks will be completed before their contracts expire on December 31st. Represented by the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, workers' discussions over the contracts are being held up by healthcare and wages. Most employees earn between $25 and $50 per hour, but live in California's expensive Marin County. Layoffs are another issue. Many film studios lay off employees after production is completed, and the union wants Lucasfilm to give workers the opportunity to learn to use new software so they can compete in the computer graphics market. In 2002, the AFL-CIO gave George Lucas, founder of Lucasfilm, an award for his commitment to collective bargaining.
The National Hockey League rejected a players' union contract offer this week, continuing their nearly three-month-long lockout. Up 14% from September, the union's latest proposal includes a 24% cutback in salaries for the 2004-05 season. The NHL is seeking salary caps or cost certainty. The league is expected to issue a counterproposal today.
Workers at a New York Times printing plant are raising allegations that they have been subjected to racial and religious discrimination. The lawsuit was filed by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission for workers at the paper's Addison, New Jersey plant. The lawsuit says that Hispanic, Black, and Jewish employees were denied overtime assignments, seniority rights, and promotions. They also claim that supervisors at the plant used derogatory racial and religious terms. The suit claims that the Times has long been aware of the incidents, but has done nothing to correct the behavior. The New York Times management has declined to answer reporters' questions concerning the incidents.
The state of Missouri's rapid response team is meeting with some of the 900 Ford workers facing layoff early next year at Ford's St. Louis plant. The plant's second shift is being eliminated. The rapid response team tries to help workers get transfers, new jobs, or training for new careers. These services are provided to the Ford workers free of charge. Missouri's governor worked with Ford to try and keep work at the St. Louis plant, but the second shift will be eliminated nonetheless.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Next time you drop your kid off at daycare, be sure to thank the child care workers. A new study by the Working for America Institute says that the median wage of child care workers in the U.S. is only $7.90 an hour, compared with an average of $13.53 an hour for all other jobs. Low pay, lack of benefits, and little room for advancement are causes of high turnover in the daycare industry. The study states that employers must provide workers with better wages and training for the quality of the daycare system to improve.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
No one knows what it's like to feel these feelings.
like I do. And I blame you.
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. Mike Jeffress believes that many thousands of hours put into prayer were responsible for America coming to her senses and embracing the traditional values and principles of the Bible. Mike is a senior pastor of Providence Road Church in Chesapeake, Virginia, and the author of a book, The Prayer of Jehoshaphat for America, which will be out apparently in January. Is that right, Mike?
That's correct. It's available for ordering right now online. It can be fulfilled through Amazon.com, but it'll be distributed in stores next month.
Great. And you suggest that we return to the traditional values and principles of the Bible. I'm wondering, when can I get my second, third, and fourth wives?
That's the Book of Mormon, not the Bible.
Well, actually, even in the New Testament,
no,
you know,
it's to Mormons. I didn't mean it that way.
But, no, but even in the New Testament, Paul makes the point in I believe in his letters to the Romans, it may be his letter to the Ephesians, that a minister of the church should be a man who has one wife. In other words, you know,
that's
who has
correct.
Not
that's
more than one wife.
That's in the pastoral epistles.
Exactly. But his point was that's only if you're going to be a pastor. That the average person is allowed to have two, three, four, five. What, you know, I mean, how many wives did, for example, David have? Or
well,
Solomon. How many wives did Solomon have? Wasn't it 700?
Well, there's a difference in what is God's ideal will and what we see sometimes demonstrated in the lives of his people, for sure. Let's ask that question to Jesus. When he was on earth and some of the leaders came to him to ask his opinion about marriage and divorce and remarriage and all those things, what did he do? He said, you know, you've seen some bad standards because of the hardness of your hearts, and God has allowed and looked over some things. But if you'll go back to creation, God revealed there what he really had in mind in giving one man, one woman for life. That's the ideal, and that's what Jesus calls his disciples.
You know, I have to say, Mike Jeffress, in all due respect from one, as you know, from one Christian to another, I've read literally the entire Bible through four times. Every night you read 20 minutes and you read the whole Bible all the way. I did that for 4 years in a row. And not to mention, you know, being raised in the church and all that.
Right.
I can't recollect anywhere in the Bible where Jesus said anything that resembled what you just said.
Well,
can you give me a citation,
there, if you
please?
Read in the Gospel of Matthew,
okay.
Mark.
Where in Matthew?
Where Jesus, when they came up and said, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for any reason, Jesus says, you know, have you not read that in the beginning he created them male and female, and for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So,
right. So
it's there. Maybe on your fifth time through, the Holy Spirit can...
No, you're right. You're right in that quote, but he wasn't saying that exclusively one woman. It is in the singular form. I haven't gone back and read the Greek.
Right.
The norm of the day, the absolute norm of the day, was for men to have more than one wives, and I don't recall Jesus ever coming out against that.
Yeah, I don't think it was really the norm in Jewish culture in the day of Jesus. Certainly, in the Roman culture and in Greek culture that abroad that was the case, and I think that's why you've got Paul in 1 Corinthians. Saying, you know, in whatever state you were called, you can remain. In other words, God was allowing for people to come to him, realizing they're not going to be able to undo everything that's been done in their life prior to their conversion. But, you know, just because there are some exceptions to the rule doesn't mean that there is an ideal standard that's set, and it's demonstrated in creation, in the creation of Adam and Eve.
Then, okay. In Exodus 21:7. It talks about the appropriate way to sell your daughters into slavery. I have two daughters. How much do you think I should get for them?
Yeah, well, I don't know about all that, Tom. I mean,
Mike, my point is, I'm not trying to take this lightly. I mean, and you and I are both familiar with the vagaries of the Bible. Reading, for example. The book of Joshua just was a wincing experience for me, as I'm sure it was for you. God telling him to go into the city of Ai and kill every living thing, cut open the bellies of pregnant women, you know, put the head of the king on a stake and things like that. I still am baffled by a God that would do that.
That's because...
And I think we can agree there are a lot of mysteries.
I mean, God is God and we're not, and... And we're going to wrestle with some of these things, and we don't know how things play out. For example, when Joshua was given that command to go and destroy some of these cities, we don't know for how many centuries, you know, God had been trying to break through to these people and save them. And sometimes, I mean,
until he finally decided to sell.
God did use armies to bring judgment on people because of sin, because righteousness exalts a nation, but sin's a reproach to any people. So,
and so you're of the opinion that it's just fine if somebody says God told me to pull together an army and go kill these folks that they should.
No,
do
I
that.
Don't think that. That's not what I'm saying at all. I do think that the Bible is the Word of God, and it does present His will for us.
If it's the Word of God, then God's changing His mind, isn't He? An awful lot. I mean, throughout the Bible, including the New Testament, you know, slavery is sanctioned.
Yeah, I think what you see is God allowing accommodations and trying to make the best of situations with His people as they struggle to know more about Him and understand what that perfect will is. Like in regard to the marriage issue, God's ideal will is one man, one woman for life. Now back to the way you introduced me here about the moral values. You know, there was a recent poll done by Barna that indicated they did a survey between November the 3rd and November the 6th and found that 67% of adults surveyed who considered themselves to have an active faith, and that means in the past week they went to church, they've prayed to God and read their Bible outside of church, 67% of them did not vote for Kerry, did vote for Bush. So I think clearly, whether we agree with the choice or not, I do think that we have to concede that moral values did play a role in this past election.
So you're suggesting that people who go to church have moral values and people who don't go to church don't have moral values?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Isn't that what you just said?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
You said, people who go to church vote for Bush.
I've dealt with people in church all my life that don't have the values of Jesus Christ.
And there are people who don't go to church who are strongly rooted in moral values, are there not?
I think you can. I mean, the Bible has examples of people. The Bible talks about the law of on the heart, the law of conscience. In fact, that's what our founding fathers spoke in terms of. God has a natural law, and He has a revealed law.
Right, and this is what brings me to this issue, Mike. It sounds to me, when you make comments like that, you know, the majority of the voters who voted for Bush are churchgoers, those who voted for Kerry were not churchgoers, and therefore, people with moral values were voting for Bush. Conflating church attendance with moral values,
I'm just reporting what the results of the survey is.
No, you weren't. You're making a very clear implication.
I mean, active in faith voted for Bush. I mean, that's just the results of the survey.
Active in
fact, Newsweek. You know, Newsweek
active
did
in,
a
active in Christian
ahead,
active in active in Christian faith.
That's correct. Which is the heritage of the United States of America.
In part.
In fact, Newsweek reported the results of their survey on December the 5th. It's posted at MSNBC.com and various other places.
Mike, I'm not disputing the statistics with you at all. I'm not disputing them. What I'm saying is that what I'm seeing from folks like yourself who are out there in the media and who are both promoting Christianity and a particular political point of view is, in my mind, first of all, an absolute violation of Jesus' instruction to render unto Caesar what is Caesar and unto God what is God's, number one. So I would say that what you're doing is, in a way, in my opinion, blasphemous. And
you're
secondly,
to that opinion.
Yeah, I know.
And I
know you disagree with it. And secondly, I would say that what it is doing is, and language like, you know, this news release you sent here, after years of gaining political ground, the U.S. homosexual lobby may be in retreat, promotes a kind of intolerance that we haven't seen in the United States since the civil rights movement, when people in the South were you know, willing to lynch African Americans, go after
blacks.
Well,
I think if you to take the homosexual lobby and turn that into a civil rights issue, I think is a slap in the face to
the
every
Bible. The
in
Bible
the
explicitly
States.
Countenances slavery. It explicitly endorses slavery. In fact. And yes, you're right. The Bible has verses in it which suggest that it's an abomination to engage in homosexual sex. It's also an abomination to wear clothing made of...
You can gain your freedom, do. I mean, God deals with us where we are and tries to take us to somewhere we're not.
Yeah. So you don't think that what you're doing is promoting intolerance?
No, I am calling for the same... You know, you talk about wanting to get back to the values of our founders and the values of democracy. If you do that, those values were shaped and born from the Bible.
I don't recall any of our founders speaking out against homosexuality. And I've written three books on the founders and read them extensively.
Okay, but what you will find is that the founders were influenced in their political philosophy by the Bible. 34%.
Okay, I don't recall Jesus speaking out about homosexuality even once, Mike. Do you?
I'm sorry?
I don't recall Jesus speaking out about homosexuality even once. Do you?
The Bible talks about sexual immorality. And,
when did Jesus speak out about homosexuality?
I don't think there is a specific...
No, there isn't.
Example in his ministry of addressing it because, frankly, there weren't many homosexuals walking the street in Jerusalem.
Oh, come on, Mike. Give me a break. Come on. Are you trying to tell me that homosexuality is something that just has appeared with our society and didn't exist back then?
I'm not going to pit Jesus against Paul or against the rest of the Bible. Clearly, Leviticus 18 says you don't lie with a man as with a man. That's an abomination to the Lord. It doesn't matter what kind of context it is. It's just...
And Leviticus 25:44 says that you can have slaves as long as you buy them from a neighboring nation. So we can buy slaves from Canada and Mexico, but we can't have them locally. Leviticus 15 says you should never touch a woman when she's menstruating.
You're wanting to bring in issues of culture and mix them in with what are timeless principles and moral values.
Leviticus 11 says that you should put people to death if they eat shellfish, Mike?
I'm sorry?
I mean, you know, I just don't get it. How you're selectively quoting Leviticus. And Leviticus has some real... Leviticus says you shouldn't shave your beard. Leviticus says that you shouldn't wear clothing made of two different kinds of fabric. And these were crimes for which you could be punished with death.
Timeless moral values and principles from what were things that were tied to culture and...
But in Leviticus, it doesn't say these are... It doesn't say, hey, this one's endless and a moral principle and these other ones aren't. It says these are all of equal importance.
Tom, I know you're an educated man, and God gave you the gift of a mind and common sense. Those are things that...
But Mike, today there are still a lot of people who agree with Leviticus. You go hang out in the Hasidic community, and you're going to find people who are wearing clothing made of 100% cotton because they will not mix two fabrics together because Leviticus says not to do it. They don't cut the I forget what they call the forelocks, the hair coming down off their, because Leviticus says not to do it. They're absolutely fine. They won't eat shellfish. They're keeping kosher. But you're picking and choosing. You're saying there's part of Leviticus that you agree with, other parts you don't, and you're going to turn this into a national issue and trash gay people around it. Why not trash shellfish eaters?
I'm not trashing gay people. If I'm trashing anything, it's a choice. It's a moral value. You know, you wrote a
book. So you're suggesting homosexuality.
What would Jefferson do?
Right.
So may I quote Jefferson? He said, "To the corruptions of Christianity, I am indeed opposed. I am too. Those who have corrupted it and twisted it, taken things out of context, misused it, misapplied it, absolutely." But Jefferson went on to say this, though. He said, "To the corruptions of Christianity I am indeed opposed, but not to the genuine precepts of Jesus himself. I am a Christian in the only sense in which he wished anyone to be, sincerely attached to his doctrines in preference to all others," in a letter dated April 21st, 1803, to fellow Declaration of Independence signer,
right,
Dr. Benjamin Rush.
I encourage you to read more of Jefferson's letters to Ben Rush, because his correspondences with Benjamin Rush were just awesome. And the caveat that he threw in to that quote that you just gave, in which he said, in the true sense... You know, Jefferson rewrote the New Testament and took all the miracles out of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's still in print, the Jefferson Bible. It's still in print. And that great quote that stands over the top of the Jefferson Memorial of I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility toward every form of tyranny imposed upon the mind of man. It's from another letter that he wrote to Benjamin Rush.
Mm-hmm.
You familiar with the context of it?
No.
It was 2 months before the election of 1800. And Jefferson, here's the actual letter. I'll read it to you. Dear sir, this is Benjamin Rush. I promised you a letter on Christianity, which I have not forgotten. I do not know that it would reconcile the genus irritable Vatum, the angry poets, who are all in arms against me. Their hostility is on too interesting a ground to be softened. The delusion on the clause of the Constitution, he's talking about the First Amendment, which while it secured the freedom of the press, also covered the freedom of religion, had given to the clergy a very favorable hope of attaining an establishment of Christianity throughout the United States. And as every sect believes his own form, the true one, everyone perhaps hoped for his own, but especially the Episcopalians and Congregationalists. The returning good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes, and the preachers believe that any portion of power confided to me, such as being elected president, this was 2 months before he was elected president, will be exerted in opposition to their schemes. And they believe rightly, for I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me, but in their minds it is enough too.
Yeah.
That is Jefferson talking about Christianity in America, if you're going to quote Jefferson.
But he still, in his heart of hearts, was committed to the teachings of Jesus and would not want to enact a law that would be in violation of that. Wouldn't you agree?
I agree, and that's why I think that Jesus would be horrified by anybody trying to write discrimination into the Constitution of the United States, which is what you guys are talking about doing. Hey, Mike, we got to take a break here. I'm sorry. I just got caught up with the time, but we'll pick it up on the other side. We'll finish this conversation. Plus, we've got a bunch of callers who want to talk to you. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 19 minutes after the hour. We're talking with Mike Jefferis, the author of, I'll tell you right away, Prayer of Jehoshaphat.
Bonjour. My name is Michel, and I founded the Organic Wine Company with my sister 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines yet, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious that when turned into wine, you can really taste the difference. Our wines are delicious and eco-friendly, so I want to make it very easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you three of my favorite organic French wines at half their regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. C'est magnifique. And if you don't agree, I will gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, which is ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. Populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available in bookstores everywhere.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
Scientists document the decline of amphibians around the world, and they say the same problem could hit other types of animals in the future. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. Amphibians are extremely sensitive animals, and their numbers are in decline. A recent study found that one-third of all amphibian species are at risk of extinction. That adds up to about 1,800 species altogether, and of those, several hundred are headed toward extinction rapidly. The study is called the Global Amphibian Assessment. It was directed by Simon Stewart, a biologist who works for the International Union for Conservation of Nature. Stewart says disease and climate change appear to be two particularly nasty problems.
The amphibians have narrow ecological tolerances, and so they are often the first species to be affected by new emerging threats, as has proven to be the case in these declines associated with disease and climate change. If the global environment continues to deteriorate for reasons such as these, and especially if climate change continues, it can only be expected to affect other groups of species that are hardier and more robust.
Stewart uses the word sinister to describe problems that now threaten amphibians. He says they were unpredicted and unpredictable. He says similar problems could hit birds and mammals in the not-too-distant future.
I think as long as we continue to let the basic life support systems of the planet erode, we're going to see more sinister happenings like this. The amphibians are important in their own right, we believe, but they're also a wake-up call for many other things.
The full report is available online. The web address is globalamphibians.org. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
Exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And where that foghorn blows, I will be coming home.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Mike Jeffress, who is the author of The Prayer of Jehoshaphat for America. Boy, the story of Jehoshaphat is one of my absolute favorites. What was his prayer?
His prayer that
I used to know it in Hebrew.
The basis of my book is, O our God, will you not judge them? For we have no power to face this vast army that's attacking us.
Yeah.
We do not know what to do, but our eyes are upon you. And I think in the context of our war on terrorism and a lot of other things going on in America, that's an important one. Some principles that
I agree. I absolutely agree, have. Mike. It was Hodu Ladonai Ki Tov Ki La'olam Hasto. That's the prayer that he sang as he led the army, and he actually led the priests at the head of up into what he thought was going to be a battle. Turned out it wasn't. It's an amazing story.
The battle belonged to the Lord.
There you go. Mike is
the
senior pastor.
And I think that's what happened, Tom, when we uphold godly values such as our founding fathers gave to us, that God blesses us for that and gives us protection, and when we don't, it's removed.
Mike, I don't disagree with you. Mike is the senior pastor, Providence Road Church. Mike, we've got 2.5 minutes. I got a whole stack of callers here. I'm going to ask you to give short answers. I'm going to ask our callers to ask short questions, and I'm not going to butt in a whole bunch. You've heard my rant already. 1-866-889-8894. Ed in California is on the line with Mike Jeffress. Hey, Ed.
Hey. Specifically, where in the Bible does your salvation come from what I do?
Okay. Ed, thank you for the question. Mike?
My salvation does not come from what you do. It comes from what Jesus did on the cross and being raised from the grave on the third day.
And how you respond to it, I would add. Titus in North Carolina. Titus in North Carolina is on the line.
Hey.
Titus, you got an awful loud phone there. Okay, quickly.
Hey, I'm calling from my truck here.
Uh-huh.
And the question that I would have would be, it's more of a statement than a question. The Bible says that God gave us all free will. So when you're talking about homosexuals, when you're talking about people that commit have abortions and all of that, you have to allow our Christian right would be to tell them the truth, not force them to do what we would want them to do, but allow them to make their decisions by loving them and treating them the way we should treat them. Let God be their judge and not man.
Okay, good point, Titus. Why are we making this a law? Why do you want to make this stuff into law, Mike?
Well, I think first of all, I agree with the caller that, you know, we need to love everyone. Jesus certainly modeled reaching out and not just throwing stones at people. In fact, when the Jews wanted to throw stones at the woman caught in adultery, Jesus offered her compassion and a second chance. So,
right.
So it's, the Christian message is not one of condemnation. It's one of redemption.
Then again, why write it into law? We've only got about 10 seconds here. I'll give you the last word. Write it into law?
As far, I think our law should reflect that righteousness. I agree with George Washington in his inaugural address that the propitious smiles of heaven, you know, cannot be expected on a nation who would forget the and disregard the eternal order, which
got it, Mike. We're just flat out of time. I appreciate your being with us, Mike Jeffress. His book,
thank you so much,
The Prayer of Jehoshaphat for America. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way: to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Lucasfilm employees are hoping the Force is with them. Nearly 500 computer graphic workers at Industrial Light and Magic are losing faith that talks will be completed before their contracts expire on December 31st. Represented by the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, workers' discussions over the contract are being held up by healthcare and wages. Most employees earn between $25 and $50 per hour, but live in California's expensive Marin County. Layoffs are another issue. Many film studios lay off employees after production is completed, and the union wants Lucasfilm to give workers the opportunity to learn to use new software so they can compete in the computer graphics market. In 2002, the AFL-CIO gave George Lucas, founder of Lucasfilm, an award for his commitment to collective bargaining.
The National Hockey League rejected a players' union contract offer this week, continuing their nearly three-month-long lockout. Up 14% from September, the union's latest proposal includes a 24% cutback in salaries for the 2004-05 season. The NHL is seeking salary caps or cost certainty. The league is expected to issue a counterproposal today.
Workers at a New York Times printing plant are raising allegations that they have been subjected to racial and religious discrimination. The lawsuit was filed by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission for workers at the paper's Addison, New Jersey plant. The lawsuit says that Hispanic, Black, and Jewish employees were denied overtime assignments, seniority rights, and promotions. They also claim that supervisors at the plant used derogatory racial and religious terms. The suit claims that the Times has long been aware of the incidents, but has done nothing to correct the behavior. The New York Times management has declined to answer reporters' questions concerning the incidents.
The state of Missouri's rapid response team is meeting with some of the 900 Ford workers facing layoff early next year at Ford's St. Louis plant. The plant's second shift is being eliminated. The rapid response team tries to help workers get transfers, new jobs, or training for new careers. These services are provided to the Ford workers free of charge. Missouri's governor worked with Ford to try and keep work at the St. Louis plant, but the second shift will be eliminated nonetheless.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Next time you drop your kid off at daycare, be sure to thank the child care workers. A new study by the Working for America Institute says that the median wage of child care workers in the U.S. is only $7.90 an hour, compared with an average of $13.53 an hour for all other jobs. Low pay, lack of benefits, and little room for advancement are causes of high turnover in the daycare industry. The study states that employers must provide workers with better wages and training for the quality of the daycare system to improve.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find AMIBA online at amiba.net.
Support our troops. Shout those magnetic yellow ribbons you see on cars and trucks anywhere in America, and is certainly a sentiment that I embrace wholeheartedly. Our volunteer soldiers, as well as the reserves and National Guard, are putting their lives on the line every day for George W.'s ill-conceived and ill-prepared Iraq War. And every day, some more of those soldiers are killed. I believe that every one of the soldiers sent over there by Washington politicians deserves the fullest support available from those of us sitting safely and comfortably back here at home. But they are not getting it. Support our troops has to be more tangible than putting a yellow magnet on your car. That's rhetoric, not support. How many of us know, for example, that Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and gang have rushed our troops into that war without the protective armor required to save their lives from bullets and blasts? An unforgivable, scandalous failure of leadership that continues to this day. And how many of the yellow magnet people are aware of how our government, quote, supports those troops who die in Iraq? While it's been widely reported that the families of civilians killed in the horrible 9/11 terrorist attacks have received an average of about $3 million each in overall compensation, do you know what the compensation is for the families of soldiers who were killed in Iraq? It's $12,000. A spouse is gone forever. A child has lost a father or mother. A lifetime breadwinner is taken from the family. Yet the White House, Congress, and Pentagon deems that life to be worthy of a mere $12,000, even as the same public officials attend rah-rah rallies urging us to support our troops. And oh, by the way, vote for us! This is Jim Hightower saying, if you think the families of those who make the ultimate sacrifice deserve more than empty rah-rah and $12,000, call Operation Truth at 212-982-9699.
If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
1 in 4 adults has high blood pressure. If you're one of them and you have a cold, Coricidin HBP has surprising news for you. The American Heart Association recognizes that decongestants found in many leading cold medicines can raise your blood pressure and interfere with blood pressure medication. So why risk it? Only decongestant-free Coricidin HBP provides a line of safe, powerful cold and flu medication specially formulated for people with high blood pressure. So make the safe choice. Coricidin HBP. Use as directed.
Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, are they trying to take control of not only imposing religion into our laws, but also determining what is and isn't acceptable art? Now, this is nothing new, frankly. Nothing new. Been going on for a long, long time. The culture wars. But here it gets very strange. This our chimp alert for the day. Yeah. A portrait of President Bush using monkeys to form his image. Yeah, see, they're very upset. Led to the closure of a New York art exhibition over the weekend and anguished protests on Monday over freedom of expression. The title of the artwork was Bush Monkeys, small acrylic on canvas by Chris Savito, created a stir at the Chelsea Market public space, this is in Manhattan, leading the market's managers to close down the 60-piece show that was scheduled to stay up for the next month. The show featured art from the upcoming issue of Animal Magazine, a quarterly publication featuring emerging artists. I think it's a particularly appropriate piece of art for a magazine called Animal Magazine. Becky Turco organized the show. She says, we had tons of people, like more than 2,000 people, show up for the opening on Thursday night. Then this manager, this is interesting. I mean, it wasn't John Ashcroft. It was a manager of the art gallery. This manager saw the piece, and this guy just kind of flipped out. The show is over, he said. Get this work down, or I'm going to arrest you, he said. It's been kind of wild. I guess so. Turco took the show down on Saturday and moved the artwork to his small downtown animal gallery. Calls to the management of Chelsea Market for comment were not returned. From afar, the painting looks like a likeness of George W. Bush, but when you get closer, you see the image is made up of chimpanzees or monkeys swimming in a marsh. Yeah, have you seen the one that it looks like George Bush from a distance, and when you get closer, you see that it's made up of over 1,000 pictures of, you know, faces of men and women? And you notice, when you look really closely, that most of them are wearing military uniforms. And then you suddenly get that horrible realization that these are the photos of the people who have died in Iraq. The Americans who have died in Iraq. And you step back 2 feet, and it looks like a picture of George Bush. You get up close, and you can see that there's over 1,000 faces making this picture up. Well, this guy didn't go that far. He just made it up out of monkeys. 23 years old. He's selling his artwork for $3,500. He says, it seems like people get a kick out of it. When they see it, they really almost do a double take. I like the reaction people get. He plans to auction the painting and donate the proceeds to an organization dedicated to the freedom of expression. This is much deeper than art, he says. This is fundamental American rights, freedom of speech. To see that something like this can happen, especially in a place like New York City, is mind-boggling and scary. So, our chimp alert for the day. It's just a... Oh, George, calm down. That's Curious George. It's, of course, Curious George. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Yes, Reverend Hartman, how are you?
Well, I've actually been there and done that, but that's a whole other story. So.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so what's up?
Well, I thought you did an excellent job with that gentleman there. What's interesting is that when folks like that come along, they're almost daring you, you know, to say, well, I believe in the Bible, and here it is, and how dare you question my faith. But you, as a Christian, actually hoisted him on his own petard with that book of Leviticus.
Oh, and I could have gone a whole lot farther. It's just we only had 20 minutes.
Well, of course. And, of course, these precepts that he's talking about, well, let's think about them. Don't steal. Don't steal your neighbor's wife. Don't kill. You know, correct me if I'm wrong, but those tenets are part of almost every religious faith. Buddhism,
yeah.
Confucian.
Well, Thomas Jefferson makes this point, and I quote him at length in this in his correspondence with John Adams. John Adams, by the way, agreed with him on this. In my book, What Would Jefferson Do? You've just got I just reprinted the letters, and as far as I can tell, it's the first time that anybody's actually printed these letters between Jefferson and Adams. Most people read books about things, you know, and a few of his letters have been recycled for 100-some-odd years. I actually went back and spent 4 years reading his original letters, and so an awful lot of the stuff that he wrote that has never been published is in this book. And not to plug the book, but just, you know, to say a lot of people just don't understand Jefferson, and you really have to read 4,000 or 5,000 of his letters to get a sense of what he's really all about. And he goes back and he says that in the year something like 1200 or 1300 was when the first what he calls fraud of the clergy occurred, when in England, and I'm forgetting who it was, but David Hume, the historian, the Tory historian of the 15th or 16th century, maybe 17th century. Actually, yeah, Hume was in the 70s. He lived in the late 1600s. Hume was the one who was quoting this guy, was saying that the British common law was based on Christianity, and which is the argument that is made by folks today for Christianizing American law and merging church and state. And Jefferson goes through this thing where he says this is an absolute fraud. He points out that the British common law came about in the 500s. Before the Heptarchy, before the five kings, which occurred in the 700s, and that was when the conversion to Christianity occurred. And so he says, you know, for 200 years, British common law existed. All the foundations of British common law, which stand to this day, for 200 years, and I quote Thomas Jefferson to James to John Adams, for 200 years before the phrase Jesus Christ was heard uttered on the continent, end quote, or on the island, rather, of England, end quote. And I'm quoting from memory, but I know it's right.
Well,
it's just so straightforward. Of the Ten Commandments, there are only two of them that are actually part of our law. Don't kill, don't steal.
Right.
Should we make a law that says you can't make a graven image? All the artists would be out of business.
Well, the Catholic Church itself
would be out of business.
And in fact, the Protestant churches that have stained glass.
Sure. I mean, the folks who are actually holding that law are the Muslims. You go to a mosque, you won't see any pictures.
Yeah, and of course, they're not a very good representative of God on earth. But I think you did an excellent job there, because I think Leviticus, for instance, I kind of hung around with Jehovah's Witnesses for years, although I never joined them. And you know, they have this prohibition against blood transfusions.
Yes.
Which comes from Leviticus.
That's right.
Now they've twisted it, and I finally got away from them. But the point is, there are other things in there, like as far as your dietary law, you're not supposed to eat anything with fat in it. But nobody is disfellowshipped from Jehovah's Witnesses for eating food with fat in it. And, you know, everyone picks and chooses. I mean, my guess is a lot of people that condemn sexual immorality are people that just plain don't like sex that much, and it's easy to, because they're uncomfortable with it, to say it's the greatest sin on earth.
Actually, I think that there's some truth to that, but I think that the larger truth with regard to these folks who are using religion or pseudoscience or whatever to basically attack homosexuality is that they are, at their core, fearful people.
And they're
fearful of an other. You know, anybody that they don't understand, anybody that they perceive as an other, they become fearful of. And so in order to deal with their fear, they have to villainize the other and try to control the other. And this is, you know, and we have a long history of this. I mean, white people doing it with black people in this country for four centuries. Now with gays, men against women. It goes on and on. I mean, there's no shortage. Protestants against Catholics. Look at the wars that were going on in Massachusetts. I mean, look at it's just incredible the history of Massachusetts.
Oh, sure,
in the 19th century when the Know-Nothings took over the legislature of Massachusetts in the 1870s, and it was a Protestant secret society. Their handshake, they had a secret handshake, and when they shook hands in this particular secret way, they would say, "I know nothing," and the other person would say, "I know nothing," and that was how you knew. The actual organization was called the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, and it was a Protestant secret society, and they took over the Massachusetts legislature. I forget the exact year. I think it was 1877, and they were the ones who introduced in the 1880s, who introduced compulsory public education into the United States. It was the first state to do this was Massachusetts, and the first community was one of the suburbs of what is now Boston. And the reason that they did it was because so many Catholics had come over because of the potato famine of 1844, not to mention just, you know, economic immigrants, people trying to get out from under the thumb of England. All these Irish Catholics had come over, and they were all settling in Boston. And the Protestants who were running the state government were concerned that the Catholics were organizing political power. And the way that they were doing it was by having these coherent, cohesive communities, Catholic communities, where they all went to church, they were teaching their kids, they had the Catholic schools were forming. And Horace Mann came along and said to them, he'd been trying to peddle his idea of schools to corporations to create good workers for the factories, and they weren't buying it. So he came to the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, and he said, "You want to break the back of a potential Catholic rebellion, of the Catholic threat to Protestant control of the state of Massachusetts? Here's how you do it. Institute compulsory public education that is not Catholic." And it took about 5-6 years. There were families that were arrested. There were people who were killed for refusing to give their children up for compulsory public education. But that's the sordid tale. I actually have two of my books on ADHD tell this story. I've written about this story of public education. Tom Hartman's Complete Guide to ADHD has a whole chapter on it.
Well, you're obviously a very learned man, Tom. Those are things I didn't know. But one last thought on Protestant secret societies. Of course, the most famous one is, believe it or not, and I know you know this, is the Ku Klux Klan. You have to be a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant to be a member of the Klan.
Oh, the Klan was virulently anti-Catholic.
Yes, and anti-black and anti-Jew and everything else. Yeah. And yet those folks think that they are the most devout Protestants, you know, and that's why it kind of irritates me. I think Bill Maher.
But you know, I agree. But here's the bigger issue, Rick. My goal with having this guy on was not to trash him or belittle him or anything.
I understand. You want to point out his foibles.
Well, not even that, really. My goal, hopefully, and we really didn't have time to reach it, but I think people got it. My goal was to say, don't we have some common ground here in wanting to have a country where every life is valued, every person is honored, every person is respected? And what on earth are we doing violating, if you want to put this in the context of Christianity, violating in the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus said, you know, before you criticize the speck in your neighbor's eye, take the beam out of your own eye. Why are we promoting, not just tolerating, but promoting, aggressively promoting bigotry in the United States?
Well, I think the most salient point of what he said there was, I'm not going to pit Jesus against Paul. Well, he darn well better, because Paul was a Pharisee who murdered Christians, and Jesus, to most of us, was the Son of God.
Yeah.
He darn well better put more primacy above Jesus than Paul.
Without devolving into too much minutia, that is one of my favorite distinctions, because the Jerusalem church, which was the direct followers of Jesus, the people who knew Jesus, Peter and John and all those guys, Matthew, that church died out and was replaced by the Pauline church. Paul, who had never met Jesus when he was alive. You know, on the road to Ephesus, he had this vision that knocked him off his horse,
that's the problem.
Yeah, I think so too. And I have a lot of problems with Paul, and I don't have any problems at all with Jesus. But I don't want this to become a discussion of theology. My point was that, you know, tolerance is a Christian value, it is a human value, it is an American value, it's a Jewish value, it's an Islamic value, it is a human value. And to be promoting religion as a vehicle of intolerance is to take us back, as you point out so correctly, Rick, to take us back to the KKK-type days. And it's something that I just don't think is in the best interest of this country. I think, in fact, it's a travesty for this country to be moving in that direction. We need to wake up and recognize we're all just people here. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Bonjour, my name is Véronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you 3 of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about the Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. If you'd like to help bring the Tom Hartman program to a radio station in your area, please let us know. We have tools to help you make that happen. For more information, go to www.tomhartman.com and click on the Bring Tom Show to Your Town link on the left side of the page. Thanks for your help in bringing uncommon sense from the radical middle to your community.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Ain't you glad you got nothing to feel? Ain't you glad this all so real? Hey, babe, somebody shine on me.
And welcome back. 24 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Live on stations from coast to coast, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet. It was 97 countries last time we looked at radiopower.org, regularly listening, and occasionally showing up in our chat room, which is full up, well-populated. Now you can get there by going to tomhartman.com. It's time for our daily report from Washington, D.C., from the Talk Radio News Service. Ellen Ratner is with us. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program. Great to hear
you. Well, thank you so much. Well, you would not believe it. I'm sure you've already heard, not a big deal, that the President gave the Medal of Freedom to none other than George Tenet, former CIA director, and to Tommy Franks and to Paul Bremer.
Yeah.
And when we asked this morning at the White House, well, you know, Bremer got us in this mess or kept us in this mess by not paying for the military and, you know, just essentially not recognizing the contribution of the Iraqi people and what they needed. Tenet got us in this mess by inaccurate information. Why are they getting the Medal of Freedom?
Yeah, and what did he say?
I mean, basically because these people have made Americans, have made Iraqi and American citizens safe and brought freedom to 50 million people of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They are
real free. I mean,
isn't that unbelievable?
We're all wishing, of course, Ellen, I know you are too. We're all wishing for a good outcome in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the price that we are paying for this, and you look at the number of countries that are run by despots around the world, the price that we are paying for this is just off the wall. And to reward dysfunctional behavior is
unbelievable. This is what he said. He called Bremer a diplomat, a philanthropist, a businessman, and a fashion pioneer. To the Bremer look, coat, dress, shirt, and tie, and desert combat boots.
Well,
I mean,
that's cute.
I guess I just get speechless.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing. I'm wondering, Ellen, I have been astounded by by the lack of coverage by the New York Times and other major media outlets of what John Conyers is doing in Ohio, these hearings that were held yesterday, the testimony that was coming out that was absolutely shocking, the charges that a sitting U.S. congressman was involved in vote rigging in Florida. None of this has broken through into the mainstream media. Any idea why? Is there a discussion of it?
Well, I think that people are very, honestly, I mean, I just wrote an article. I know you do some writing for Buzzflash. I actually write for one of the right-wing columns.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I wrote about is that this is becoming, the 21st century is looking to me right now, or at least this decade is looking to me like it's a repeat of the Hollywood 10 and McCarthy kinds of things. People are afraid to go against the system, Tom.
Yeah, so journalists are afraid of being blackballed, in other words.
I think so.
As Dan Rather
was. Being cut off. And there are a few of us that, you know, how can they cut off our access? I mean, we're sort of on the outside anyhow, although actually at the White House they could cut off my access, which would not be good.
Yeah, yeah. It's when the politicians hold your economic future in their hands, And the future of the viability of your news organization, and then, as they always have, actually, but then when they start using that, as George W. Bush did with Helen Thomas, if they don't like your questions, this violates just the fundamental tenets of public discourse and openness and transparency in government. It's just, I mean, compare that with Tony Blair and Prime Minister's questions.
Oh, the Prime Minister's questions are great. One other interesting thing, the U.S. Conference of Mayors, you know, has the Sodexo USA Hunger Homelessness Survey. They released it this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And they said even with an improving economy, overall for requests for food assistance increased by an average of 14% over the last year. 96% of the cities registered an increase. Emergency shelters increased need for 6%. 70% of the 27 cities surveyed showed an increase.
Yeah.
So not pretty on the domestic front.
No,
either.
It's not. You can buy cheap stuff at Walmart, and guess what? You don't have a job anymore. I mean, that's the story that this administration is giving us. Ellen, thanks so much for your report.
I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Yep, talk to you tomorrow. Have a good one. 29 minutes past the hour.
Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Lucasfilm employees are hoping the force is with them. Nearly 500 computer graphic workers at Industrial Light and Magic are losing faith that talks will be completed before their contracts expire on December 31st. Represented by the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, workers' discussions over the contracts are being held up by health care and wages. Most employees earn between $25 and $50 per hour, but live in California's expensive Marin County. Layoffs are another issue. Many film studios lay off employees after production is completed, and the union wants Lucasfilm to give workers the opportunity to learn to use new software so they can compete in the computer graphics market. In 2002, the AFL-CIO gave George Lucas, founder of Lucasfilm, an award for his commitment to collective bargaining.
The National Hockey League rejected a players' union contract offer this week, continuing their nearly three-month-long lockout. Up 14% from September, the union's latest proposal includes a 24% cutback in salaries for the 2004-05 season. The NHL is seeking salary caps or cost certainty. The league is expected to issue a counterproposal today.
Workers at a New York Times printing plant are raising allegations that they have been subjected to racial and religious discrimination. The lawsuit was filed by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission for workers at the paper's Addison, New Jersey plant. The lawsuit says that Hispanic, Black, and Jewish employees were denied overtime assignments, seniority rights, and promotions. They also claim that supervisors at the plant used derogatory racial and religious terms. The suit claims that the Times has long been aware of the incidents, but has done nothing to correct the behavior. The New York Times management has declined to answer reporters' questions concerning the incidents.
The state of Missouri's rapid response team is meeting with some of the 900 Ford workers facing layoff early next year at Ford's St. Louis plant. The plant's second shift is being eliminated. The rapid response team tries to help workers get transfers, new jobs, or training for new careers. These services are provided to the Ford workers free of charge. Missouri's governor worked with Ford to try and keep work at the St. Louis plant, but the second shift will be eliminated nonetheless.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Next time you drop your kid off at daycare, be sure to thank the child care workers. A new study by the Working for America Institute says that the median wage of child care workers in the U.S. is only $7.90 an hour, compared with an average of $13.53 an hour for all other jobs. Low pay, lack of benefits, and little room for advancement are causes of high turnover in the daycare industry. The study states that employers must provide workers with better wages and training for the quality of the daycare system to improve.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And who's going to be the one to say it was no good what we done?
I'll do that.
I dare a man to say I'm too young.
Well, I'm not going to say that, but I'll say it was no good what we done. 27 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. We're going to do our NLP lesson for the week. It's the second half hour, the second hour of the Tuesday program. First, let me take a call from Alice in Humboldt County. Alice has been patiently waiting on the phone here. And Alice, what's on your mind? Welcome to the program.
Well, Tom, this is Alice from Humboldt County.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that everyone who subscribes to a newspaper that won't report on these efforts in Ohio to deal with the election fraud, we should quit the paper and tell them why.
That's an excellent suggestion, Alice, an excellent suggestion. I absolutely agree with you, or at least threaten to quit the newspaper. Say,
yeah,
you know, call up and say, I will give you, you know, 3 days to start reporting on what John Conyers is doing, and if I don't read about it in the newspaper, then I'm going to just go back to reading the New York Times online, or actually not even the New York Times, because they're not reporting. I'm going to go back to reading commondreams.org and buzzflash.com and opednews.com and takebackthemedia.com and all these other, you know, some more rational news sources. Alice, excellent.
And we can subscribe again when they decide to report what we need to know.
There you go. There you go. Yep. Well said. Absolutely well said, Alice. Thank you very much. I do appreciate it. And it's an important, this is an important issue. We'll return to this later in the program. Right now, it's time for our NLP class of the week. We've been getting a lot of very positive response to this. I know we don't get a lot of phone calls about it because it's not controversial stuff. But, boy, the emails and the activity on our message board, and it seems that people are appreciating this. If you're not, or if you are, let us know. We'll continue it or not. But so far, so good. This week, today, what I want to share with you is, in the context of NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, is goal setting. How do you set goals? Napoleon Hill, back in the 1930s, in the late 1920s, actually, he was a young reporter, and he was invited into the office of Andrew Carnegie, who at that time was the richest man in the world. And Carnegie sat Napoleon Hill down in his office, and he said, you know, young man, I've been following your writing. You're a very competent writer, and I have come across a secret. And I think that you are a good enough writer that you can share this secret with the world, because I think it's important, and it's an important secret. Well, this certainly got Napoleon Hill's interest. And Carnegie said, I'm going to tell you the secret right now, and you can write it down. But before you write a book about it, I first would like you to go out and interview, and I'll pay you to do this. Carnegie paid his salary for a year to do this. I'd like you to go out and interview at least 40 or 50 of the most successful people you can find and ask them how they found their success. And let's see if my secret is something that I'm the only person who knows, or if this is a universal principle that everyone else has used. And then put that in the book. So Napoleon Hill went out and he interviewed a bunch of folks.
And here is a list of a few of the names. Many of them you wouldn't recognize because they were people who were famous in the 20s but no longer are. But here are a few of the people who, when Napoleon Hill interviewed them, they said that they became successful in their lives. And I would say successful in some cases politically, because two of them were presidents of the United States. One of them was a senator and a presidential candidate. They became successful because they had applied Andrew Carnegie's principles. And about a third of the people on this list actually told Napoleon Hill that in previous years, Andrew Carnegie had shared his secret with them and they had used it to achieve their success. Now, here's the list that Napoleon Hill shares. Henry Ford, William Wrigley, E.M. Statler, the Statler Building in New York, Cyrus Curtis, George Eastman, as in Eastman Kodak, Charles M. Schwab, Theodore Roosevelt, President of the United States, King Gillette, founder of the Razor Company, Albert Hubbard, Wilbur Wright, inventor of the airplane, remember? Thomas Edison, F.W. Woolworth, Edward Filene, Dr. Alexander Graham Bell, J. Ogden Armour, John D. Rockefeller, Clarence Darrow, President Woodrow Wilson, President William Howard Taft, Luther Burbank, Senator Jennings Randolph, and William Jennings Bryan. Now, what did these guys know in common that was this great secret? Napoleon Hill wrote a book called Think and Grow Rich about this secret and nothing else. It was about how to apply the secret to making money. And you can, and I'm going to share the secret with you in the next 10 minutes. And you can use this to make money. You can use it to accomplish anything in your life. You can use it, and my hope is that we will all collectively use it to transform America back into a nation of democracy and egalitarian ideals where we dismiss the bigots among us and we hold high the value of democracy and justice, not just here in the United States, but all around the world. Truthfulness from our and honesty by our politicians and so on. I mean, you know the list. Here's the in Faust, Goethe made a comment in his book Dr. Faustus, or about Dr. Faustus. He said, "Until one is committed, there is hesitancy. Always the chance to draw backwards, always ineffectiveness. When you are committed, whatever you can do or dream you can do, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. Begin it now." My mentor, Gottfried Müller, used to say, "The beginning is always half the work." So then comes the question, well, how do you begin? This, by the way, I have not yet shared with you the secret of Napoleon Hill's secret. How do you begin? Well, here's where it is. It has to do with setting a goal in a very specific and particular way. If you do this correctly, the goal becomes your future. This positive future that you're imagining, that you're holding, that you have developed or invented for yourself, becomes like a magnet that draws you towards it even when you're not paying any attention to it, if you do this right. The goal, first of all, must be congruent with your sense of self and your belief in your purpose for being here on Earth. And if you've never asked yourself those questions, I mean, there are some folks who have sort of a metaphysical notion that they actually incarnated for a particular purpose. There are others who would frame it in a more secular way and say, or a more medical way and say, well, you know, my genetics or my neurobiology or the way that my body and mind are organized means that I'd make a good, you know, fill in the blank, a good firefighter, a good actor, a good writer, a good politician, a good activist, a good, you know, good banker, whatever. But I would suggest before really getting into using Hill's secret, which we haven't gotten to yet, that you give some thought to the question, what is the purpose of your life? Because people who don't have a sense of purpose, who have not found their sense of purpose, are people who are vulnerable to depression, to anxiety, and who are and to failure. They're drifting. And when you get your purpose, and I guarantee you all of us have one, and you could say, well, you know, it's just a psychological trick. I'm just imagining a purpose, but that's fine. That's fine. When you have, when you hold a purpose, this is what I'm here for. Maybe not for your whole entire life. Maybe it's just for this year. Maybe it's just for this month. But this is what I'm here for. Then it's possible to set goals. For some people, it's being a good parent, or being a good mate, a good spouse, or being a good friend to others. For some, it's being a decent human being. But you can chunk it up. You can look at the larger picture and define this in the context of a purpose. So here's how it works. After you've decided what your purpose is, the question is, in the context of that purpose, what's an appropriate long-term goal? A five-year goal, let's say. You can do this with one-year goals, five-year goals, lifetime goals. And keep in mind, there are some people who are afraid to do this because they're afraid, if I don't reach my goal, then I'm going to feel terrible about myself. Right? This is what the story that they tell themselves. It doesn't matter whether you reach it. If you do this right, you probably will. But you may also get halfway into it and new information comes along and that causes you to say, you know, I thought it was A, but really my goal is B. Or it's A shaded by B, and I need to recalibrate slightly. And that's just fine. Keep in mind, there's no failure, there's only feedback, there's no mistakes, there are only outcomes. So the goal has to be something that can be conceptualized in all three representational systems, visual, auditory, and kinesthetic. You have to be able to imagine it. And when you imagine the goal, you have to see a picture of yourself in the future accomplishing that goal. And notice how you're standing, notice how you're dressed, notice what it looks like, notice how you feel. You must see a picture of yourself in the future accomplishing that goal, number one. Number two, you must have a phrase. There must be an auditory component, a story. It can be just a couple of words that identifies that future for you. I'll tell you, a story. When I was a kid, I always wanted to be a writer. When I left home when I was 16, I had wallpapered my bedroom with rejection slips. All these articles that mostly it was for bad poetry that I was submitting to poetry magazines back then. And when I first learned this, when I first read Napoleon Hill's book when I was about 20, I wrote on the back of a business card, successful author. And I stuck it in my wallet where I'd see it. I'd put one on the dashboard of my car where I'd see it. I put one in the mirror in the bathroom. In other words, I boiled it down to two words. And I have accomplished that goal to some extent. I mean, everybody would like to have John Grisham's sales, but I think, so that was a goal, one of many, but that was a goal. So number one, you've got a picture of it. Number two, you have a sound of it. Number three, you have a feeling associated with it. And this was Napoleon Hill's secret. What he found was that people who didn't reach their goals were people who set intellectual goals. They said, well, you know, I have an education in botany, so I ought to become a great botanist. But they never became Luther Burbank, who, by the way, was one of the people that Napoleon Hill talked to. And the reason why was because they hadn't attached a powerful, burning emotion, what Hill describes as desire, to that goal. And the way that you do this is by seeing that picture of yourself in the future, doing that thing, and having that story that you're telling yourself about it, and then intentionally reaching down inside yourself and back into your memory and finding those times when there was something you really, really wanted, whether it was that toy at Christmas when you were 7 years old, or whether it was that girl in the ninth grade, or whatever it might be, or boy, when there was a time when you really wanted something, and just capture the feeling of, I really want this. This is worth working for. And bind the feeling to the picture. Now, this is not something you can do instantly. I mean, you take a first shot at it, you can do it to some extent. But it's something that needs to be reinforced over and over and over again. And that's why I suggest that you boil your goal down to a couple of words, write it on the back of a half a dozen business cards, stick one in your wallet where you see it every time you open your wallet, put one on your mirror. Sometimes you have to write it in ways that other people don't understand. You could just write the word book, for example, if you wanted to be an author, so that when people see it, they don't, you know, successful author. Because one of the other little secrets of this is don't share your goal with others until you've reached it. And here's why. Most people don't set goals. They really don't. Which is why most people don't achieve high levels of success. And so when you tell most people that you have set a goal, very often their response is to make fun of it or to question it or to try and figure out how it can't be done, because most people have can't be done stories about pretty much everything. Oh, here's why. You know, I'd like to be a famous author, but here's why it can't be done. Here's why I can't do it. And, you know, when an acorn starts to grow and you've got this little 2-inch tall oak tree, and then the second year it becomes a foot tall oak tree, and the third year it's a you know, foot and a half tall oak, those first couple of years, that oak tree, you've got to put a fence around it if you want it to grow into an oak tree, or it's going to get crushed. It's the same way with this. You define that goal and you don't share it with others because they may crush it. You keep it secret until you have accomplished it. So, or you share it perhaps with your closest. I always shared my goals with my wife. But that's it. That's it. And now visualize yourself in that future. You may want to try actually imagining that you're stepping into that future. Make a line on the floor and set the future out there in front of you. Walk out into it. Stand in the future. Look around and say, is this what I want? Just to do a check. And if it feels like, yeah, this is it, then walk back into the present and look back and see yourself in the future. Hold that picture of yourself in the future. And you can get to that. I'll give you a couple of more tips on how to make this really work effectively right after this break. Goal setting. It's our NLP class for the week. Tom Hartman here with you. Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555. And mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's The Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug, the phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartman Show absolutely without question, whether that be on the national level or the local level, and you will absolutely get results. The way you can learn more about our imported organically grown wines from France is by calling us. The phone number is 1-888-ECO-WINE, or you can visit our site at www.ecowine.com.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
Efforts to control air pollution go back several centuries, according to a new book. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Ice cores drilled from Greenland show that air pollution began when humans started smelting copper and iron thousands of years ago. But it didn't become a public issue until the 18th century, when citizen groups formed in London to fight air so black and dirty it made people sick. Joe Sherman says the fight for cleaner air became part of a morality and justice-based movement in England, which then spread to some U.S. cities by the late 18th century.
It was unjust for a lot of people in poor economic circumstances, the same way it is now. In a lot of ways, have not changed at all.
Sherman is the author of a new book called Gasp, The Swift and Terrible Beauty of Air. He traces people's views of air from Egyptian mythology to the present, and he examines how air pollution grew as a public issue. For example, smog began to evoke concern in the 1930s, in Los Angeles, of course. Sherman says L.A. then saw a huge industrial buildup in the 1940s to meet the military needs of a country at war, and the city's love affair with the automobile took off in the post-war boom. By the 1950s, people were protesting L.A.'s poor air quality.
L.A. was like the canary in the coal mine for the rest of the world because the same conditions gradually started to creep all over the place. So we have smog initially in L.A., but then as the automobile culture spread around the world and you had more and more emissions on a large daily basis surrounding cities, you had smog spreading everywhere.
Smog, mostly made up of ground-level ozone, is a public health problem in cities around the world. And it continues to plague Los Angeles. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
Good morning, America, how are you? Said, don't you know me? I'm your native son.
And welcome back.
I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans.
Yeah, some music is just so good.
I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done.
It's not a classic piece of music, but it's just it must have been a particularly good year for me when that came out. I don't know. There's just if I could sing, I'd sing along with it. Anyhow, just to wrap this thing up about goal setting, and then we're going to get back into politics in the next hour of the program and the rest of the news and news of the day and things like this. But whether you're for example, I'll share some of my goals with you. I told you not to share them with people, right? But and I have some that I don't share with people. But you know, one of my goals, and literally one of the things that I literally pray for. If you're a person who prays, you know, I encourage you to toss them into your prayers as well. Is that I can be an agent of restoring democracy and peace to the world. That I can play some role in that. I have a goal that this radio program be successful.
I have a goal that, you know, my books continue to prosper. I mean, this is and actually not. It's funny because my writing goal really doesn't have anything to do with how much money I might get from a publisher or how many books I've sold. It has to do with whether or not people's lives are positively changed as a result of the message that I share. And that's frankly my goal for this radio program as well. It's not about, you know, what are our arbitrons or how many listeners do we have or how many stations are we on. Those are a means to an end. But the end is transforming this nation and the individuals in it in a positive way, touching people's lives in a positive way, because I feel that that's my purpose. Not to sound too, you know, if that sounds fat-headed, my apologies. I, you know, that's the problem with sharing your goals with people. But you really should. And and once you've set your life goal, this thing of creating a line on the floor and walking out on it, walking out into the future, and then looking back and asking yourself, what are the steps along the way that are going to get me here? Is a really, really useful one. Because once you know what your five-year goal is, and then you look back toward the present, you can say, okay, to get to this point, to this five-year point, in the first couple of years, I've got to do this. In the first few months, I have to do this. In the first few weeks, I have to do this. And then you get to the question, and this is what Herr Mueller said. This is always half the work. This is that Goethe quote from the beginning. What are you going to do today and tomorrow to begin achieving that goal? Don't forget, until one is committed, there is hesitancy, always a chance to draw backwards, always ineffectiveness. When you are committed, whatever you can do or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. Begin it now.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Lucasfilm employees are hoping the force is with them. Nearly 500 computer graphic workers at Industrial Light and Magic are losing faith that talks will be completed before their contracts expire on December 31st. Represented by the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, workers' discussions over the contract are being held up by healthcare and wages. Most employees earn between $25 and $50 per hour, but live in California's expensive Marin County. Layoffs are another issue. Many film studios lay off employees after production is completed, and the union wants Lucasfilm to give workers the opportunity to learn to use new software so they can compete in the computer graphics market. In 2002, the AFL-CIO gave George Lucas, founder of Lucasfilm, an award for his commitment to collective bargaining.
The National Hockey League rejected a players' union contract offer this week, continuing their nearly three-month-long lockout. Up 14% from September, the union's latest proposal includes a 24% cutback in salaries for the 2004-05 season. The NHL is seeking salary caps or cost certainty. The league is expected to issue a counterproposal today.
Workers at a New York Times printing plant are raising allegations that they have been subjected to racial and religious discrimination. The lawsuit was filed by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission for workers at the paper's Addison, New Jersey plant. The lawsuit says that Hispanic, Black, and Jewish employees were denied overtime assignments, seniority rights, and promotions. They also claim that supervisors at the plant used derogatory racial and religious terms. The suit claims that the Times has long been aware of the incidents, but has done nothing to correct the behavior. The New York Times management has declined to answer reporters' questions concerning the incidents.
The state of Missouri's rapid response team is meeting with some of the 900 Ford workers facing layoff early next year at Ford's St. Louis plant. The plant's second shift is being eliminated. The rapid response team tries to help workers get transfers, new jobs, or training for new careers. These services are provided to the Ford workers free of charge. Missouri's governor worked with Ford to try and keep work at the St. Louis plant, but the second shift will be eliminated nonetheless.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Next time you drop your kid off at daycare, be sure to thank the child care workers. A new study by the Working for America Institute says that the median wage of child care workers in the U.S. is only $7.90 an hour, compared with an average of $13.53 an hour for all other jobs. Low pay, lack of benefits, and little room for advancement are causes of high turnover in the daycare industry. The study states that employers must provide workers with better wages and training for the quality of the daycare system to improve.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find Amoeba online at amiba.net.
When is an election over? When the votes are counted, right? Thus, Republican Dino Rossi says he's the new governor of Washington State. Not only were the votes counted, but also recounted by electronic machines, and Dino promptly declared himself the victor by a whopping margin of 42 votes. Yes, 42 votes out of 2.8 million votes cast on November 2nd, the tiniest margin of any gubernatorial election in U.S. history. Still, Rossi proclaimed himself governor-elect, had a victory party, and departed for a 7-day Caribbean cruise. But wait, says the Democratic candidate, Christine Gregoire, the vote is not over until every vote is counted and counted accurately. Democracy demands no less than that for elections to be legitimate, and in the Washington State case, that accuracy is very much in question. Counties report that some of their electronic recounts don't match the number of physical ballots, that they have had computer glitches, that some precincts were double counted, etc. So Gregoire is calling for a hand count of all 2.8 million votes as the only way the vote can be truly verified, and her supporters have raised the money to pay for it. Oh no, wails Rossi, we can't have this. Now back from the Caribbean, he says that he's tanned, rested, and ready. He's already been picking out new drapes and carpet for the governor's office, so he and his partisans have demanded that Gregoire be a good sport and go away. Go away? What about the right of all voters to trust that their ballots were counted as cast? The 42-vote margin is 0.0014% of the total vote, well within the margin of error for computerized counting machines. Sure, a hand count will take a few more weeks, but what's that compared to getting a governor who's actually legitimate? This is Jim Hightower saying, it's time for all of us to take a stand somewhere for the integrity of our vote. To do it in Washington State, call 206-328-2969.
The notion of a 40-hour work week is several hours short of reality. Working long hours is a given when you run your own business. That's why Sam's Club carries products to help make that easier. You can count on Sam's Club to have just what you need. Bounty paper towels, Charmin bath tissue, Puffs tissues, and other quality brands, all at everyday low costs. After all, we know that time and money are important to you. Helping you make the most of both is why we're here. Sam's Club. We are in business for small business.
One in four adults has high blood pressure. If you're one of them and you have a cold, Coricidin HBP has surprising news for you. The American Heart Association recognizes that decongestants found in many leading cold medicines can raise your blood pressure and interfere with blood pressure medication. So why risk it? Only decongestant-free Coracetin HBP provides a line of safe, powerful cold and flu medication specially formulated for people with high blood pressure. So make the safe choice. Coracetin HBP. Use as directed.
For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website. If you want to drop into our chat room, lots of some of the most extraordinary people on the web there. I never fail to learn things from the folks in our chat room. The discussion going on now about BitTorrent, something I totally don't understand. it's a very wise bunch of people. I mean that in a positive sense, not as in wise guys. Anyhow, the wonders of consolidation are upon us again in this holiday season. This is something that the founders looked upon with, shall we say, a jaundiced eye. In 1787, when James Madison was, I won't say leading, I think John Hancock officially led it, I could be wrong, but in any case, when James Madison was the official, he was the official scribe of the Constitutional Convention, and he was really, many call him the father of the American Constitution, he had spent 5 years studying the constitutions of governments all over the world and the history of constitutions, and he was the guy that everybody looked to whenever there was a question, you know, how do we do this, you know, this sort of thing. And he kept the notes, and those notes were kept secret until every member of the Constitutional Convention was dead, and then Madison authorized them to be published in his will. And the reason why, of course, was that many of the men in the Constitutional Convention were people of means and substance. They were men of wealth and power. And they were voting in many cases, in fact, in the majority of the cases, against the interests of people with wealth and power. I know this is not the story that you've heard from either the conservative extremists or the liberal extremists, but it's true. You know, I lay out all the detail of it in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? And I need not go through the super minutia right now, but the bottom line is that the Constitution was put together and voted on and voted in favor of, turned out to the public, by men who were, in many cases, working against their own personal self-interests. It was not just to protect the property and business interests of wealthy white guys. In fact, it worked against them, which is one of the reasons why there is no James Madison Foundation still passing out money, or John Hancock Foundation still passing out money, or Thomas Jefferson Dynasty, or George Washington Dynasty. None of them left dynasties. None of them. And in fact, they put into place laws that, by and large, prevented that from happening. And it wasn't until the era of the robber barons, when the railroads became so strong, as largely as a result of the Civil War, that in the decades immediately following the Civil War, the railroads were able to corrupt our political process to the point that they could change the laws of the land so that mind-boggling wealth could be accumulated in the court using the corporate form, by and large. And thus came about these new, what they were referred to as the robber barons of their time, this new aristocracy, these new kings and queens, princes and lords, let's say. The Carnegies, the Rockefellers, the Mellons, George Westinghouse, the whole bunch of them. The Huntingtons, the railroad families. All came about as a result of laws being changed in the 1870s and the 1880s
Because prior to that, it was against the law in every state in the union for a corporation to do more than one thing. If you wanted to make light bulbs and run a trucking line, you had to have two separate corporations to do it, with separate staff doing separate things. It was against the law for a corporation to own the stock of another corporation. That was called a trust or a monopoly. And when they started doing it, John Rockefeller pioneered this. He got a whole bunch of smaller oil companies together and said, listen, we'll start a trust. You guys will buy stock in it. We'll call it the Standard Oil Trust. And we'll distribute the income based on ownership in it. But it was a bunch of companies buying into it, which was something new. In the past, it had always been individuals investing in a company, not companies investing in a company. And when he did this, Ohio kicked him out in the late 1870s. They said, sorry, John, what you're doing is against the law. You're creating an enterprise that will become so wealthy and so powerful as an individual enterprise that it will make it impossible for small companies to survive. It is anti-competitive. And you will be aggregating and amassing so much wealth which can equate into political power that you may become, to quote Thomas Jefferson, a threat to the state itself, end quote. So Rockefeller said, well, if Ohio isn't going to let me do this, and it's against the law in every other state in the country, I'm going to do it anyway, and wherever I go, I'm going to be paying a lot of state taxes. What state would like to have my money? And in the 1870s, the first state to say, well, we'll take you, was New York. New Jersey. And Jersey said, we'll take you. We'll do away with the rule that says that a corporation can't be owned by other corporations. And then New York said, well, and we'll not only do that, but we'll also reduce the tax on corporations. And then New Jersey said, well, we'll not only do that, we'll also eliminate the law that says that you can only do one thing. And then Connecticut got into the act. And then finally Delaware said, we're going to change it so that a single person can create a corporation. In other words, any one person can have the benefits of the shield of a corporation. The purpose of a corporation can be a single sentence. This corporation is incorporated to do anything it's legal to do in the state of Delaware. We're going to drop our annual corporate tax. We're going to stop having the regular oversight of the Secretary of State. You can pretty much do anything you want. And ultimately, Delaware won. That's why nearly 500 of the Fortune 500 companies are Delaware corporations. But it took a little while for Delaware to win. And in the meantime, John Rockefeller ended up in New Jersey. So Standard Oil of Ohio became Standard Oil of New Jersey. And that brought about a major transformation in America. And the response to this was Senator Sherman of Ohio, in December of 1880, proposed Senate Bill No. 1, which was passed in 1881, called the Sherman Antitrust Act. And the Sherman Antitrust Act, very simple, it was just a couple of paragraphs, said any group that organizes a monopoly in order to control an industry or a business or act in a way that prevents small competitors from participating is guilty of a crime and will be subject to a fine. The individuals doing it can go to jail, and the corporation will be dissolved. The Sherman Antitrust Act. And it was the Sherman Antitrust Act and the fine tunings of it over the last 100 years that led Jimmy Carter to say to AT&T, you guys are a monopoly. You're going to have to break up. And they did. And that was really the last time that anybody took on a monopoly. And there are good reasons to take on monopolies. Monopolies are essentially anti-competitive, and even more importantly, and therefore, because they're anti-competitive, they're destructive to a stable, healthy economy, which we all would like. But even, I think, perhaps more important than that, they are anti-democratic. Because when monopolies achieve sufficient power, then politicians have to bow down before them. So all that said, here we are, the wonders of consolidation. The Associated Press reports today about 800 workers at the Swift & Company meatpacking plant here, this in Greeley, Colorado, will lose their jobs just a few days before Christmas. The layoffs take effect on December 20th, 11 days before the expiration of a contract that had Swift processing cattle from three ConAgra Foods feedlots. ConAgra, one of the nation's largest food companies, sold the lots earlier this year to Smithfield Foods Company of Smithfield, Virginia. A consolidation. Swift layoffs come amid a tough work environment in Weld County, Colorado. A program that provides rental assistance has a two-year waiting list. The county food bank is struggling to keep up with demand. The United Way has received 50 calls a day from people seeking assistance, said United Way Director, Executive Director Janine Truswell. Cattle feeder Ken Ulrich says people just don't realize how devastating this can be. The Associated Press reported back on the 10th of December, a couple days ago, that Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, used to be a Bristol corporation, they joined with Myers, it became Bristol-Myers, then they joined with Squibb, and now it's Bristol-Myers Squibb, has signed a deal to outsource operations such as information technology, finances, and human resources, a move that could pave the way for potential additional layoffs. Earlier this year, the company laid off 500 people. They reached the size where they can just... We could take this to India. And on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. I just don't understand why Americans don't look at this stuff and say, there's something wrong here. Front page. After 18-month battle, Oracle finally wins over PeopleSoft. Wins over. This was a hostile takeover, friends. David Bank wrote the article. Very well-written article. Opening sentence. Larry Ellison, he's the chairman or CEO of Oracle, founder. Larry Ellison has staked his claim as the software industry's giant, great consolidator. Now, see, 100 years ago, or 90 years ago, they would have said great robber baron, great monopolist. They're acquiring PeopleSoft for $10.3 billion. David Bank in the article goes on to say, now that he has rewritten the rules, Mr. Ellison says his roll-up of the business software market has just begun. Ellison said, we are the primary consolidator in the software industry. Doesn't anybody get how destructive this is? BEA Systems, Inc. of San Jose, California, has a current market value of about $3.5 billion. They're very attractive, according to Ellison. Once it's finalized, the PeopleSoft acquisition will radically reshape the market for software the companies use to run their financial, human resources, and other business functions, leaving just two big suppliers, Oracle and Germany's SAP AG. Just two suppliers. This used to be the land of opportunity. Used to be you could start a small business and build it up and be successful in the United States. The reason why is because we had laws that restrained big corporations from monopolizing markets. Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing those laws, and here we are, 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the Progressive News Magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way, to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
If you sell a product or service, we have listeners from coast to coast and in 97 countries who want to know about you. Reach out to our national audience with our small business advertising package. You'll pay just a fraction of what national advertising usually costs. Call now at 802-229-2288 or visit our website, tomhartmann.com, and follow the links to the small business advertising package for more information. Don't miss reaching a national audience now. 802-229-2288.
Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartmann.
Indian workers with tech support skills work for cheap and speak English just fine.
Yeah, so hire them.
It's a jobless recovery. Why pay a salary? We can outsource all the work that we need.
And once we've outsourced everything, we'll have nothing left except retail. We'll all be sitting around selling things to each other. Would you like burgers with that or fries with that burger, sir? And what are we going to be making? Nothing. You can't have a retail economy, an entirely retail economy. You can't have it. It doesn't work. You have to make something. Well, it's, but that's a whole other rant. I wanted to finish up with this. With these mergers, amid frothy, this is Gregory Zuckerman, the story under the story that I just shared with you, also on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Big mergers make a comeback as stocks and interest rate rise. Big mergers make a comeback. Like, this is good news. The big are getting bigger. The rich are getting richer. The powerful are getting more powerful. And if you'd like to break into the world of business, good luck, buddy. Amid frothy stock prices and rising interest rates, the long-dormant merger market is showing signs of awakening, writes Zuckerman. With a spate of recent high-profile multi-billion-dollar deals and intense discussions of possible blockbuster transactions. Notice all the adjectives here are, shall we say, favorable. The dollar value of deals has soared. He notes in the Wall Street Journal, in the U.S., the dollar value is up almost 30% in 2004 compared with last year. All of this is evidence in my mind that the Securities and Exchange Commission is not doing its job enforcing the law, and that nobody in Congress gives a hoot, and the whole idea of America being the land of opportunity is something that apparently our members of Congress, certainly the Republican Party, has given up on, and the Democratic Party, I think to a large extent, has forgotten about and given up on. Meanwhile, two far bigger transactions, they're talking about, you know, IBM just last week agreed to sell its personal computer division to Lenovo Group. This is for $1.25 billion. This is a Chinese company has bought IBM's computer business. Interesting irony. And then you got Oracle and PeopleSoft, the one I just told you about. And then they say two far bigger transactions are under discussion. One, a roughly $24 billion merger between healthcare company Johnson & Johnson and medical products maker Guidant Corporation. The other, an estimated $35 billion deal between telecom giants Nextel Communications and Sprint Corp. This seems to be helping the stock market, of course, with these large companies. But executives, bankers, and lawyers cite many reasons for the uptick, notes the Wall Street Journal. From easing fuel prices to high stock prices that are providing good currency for purchasers. Well, yeah. And the biggest reason, the laws against it are not being enforced. And what does this lead to? This leads to a situation, and I got to tell you, I'm going to tell you after the break what they're doing about this in New Zealand and Australia. But here in the United States, this leads to a situation where states are competing with each other to see how much of the workers' salaries they can give away, how much more property taxes they can raise on average working people, how much more they can raise state income taxes so they can give big tax breaks to these multinational corporations so that they will come into those states and hopefully provide a few jobs to the desperate masses. This also from today's Wall Street Journal. States are wooing foreign car makers. Yes, build your cars here. Take your profits back home. What's wrong with this picture is Detroit's big three automakers and their suppliers have been cutting thousands of jobs to shore up profits. State governors increasingly are wooing Asian and European car makers to bring new employment to their areas. Well, why? Because these foreign governments have, or foreign nation companies in foreign nations have all kinds of U.S. dollars because we're importing all this stuff from China. We have a $500 to $600 billion a year trade deficit, meaning that the world has $500 trillion of our money more than we're buying. So what do? They come over here and they start buying up land and building factories. No more America, friends. 29 minutes past the hour.
We're sorry. Your call cannot be completed as dialed. Please hang up.
Having a hard time connecting with someone who cares? Try the Boys Town National Hotline at 1-800-448-3000. They'll be there to help you when you need it the most, 24 hours a day. They'll even pay for the call. Simply call 1-800-448-3000.
Boys Town National Hotline, how can I help?
Time furnished by the Office of National Drug Control Policy.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Lucasfilm employees are hoping the force is with them. Nearly 500 computer graphic workers at Industrial Light and Magic are losing faith that talks will be completed before their contracts expire on December 31st. Represented by the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, workers' discussions over the contracts are being held up by healthcare and wages. Most employees earn between $25 and $50 per hour, but live in California's expensive Marin County. Layoffs are another issue. Many film studios lay off employees after production is completed, and the union wants Lucasfilm to give workers the opportunity to learn to use new software so they can compete in the computer graphics market. In 2002, the AFL-CIO gave George Lucas, founder of Lucasfilm, an award for his commitment to collective bargaining.
The National Hockey League rejected a players' union contract offer this week, continuing their nearly three-month-long lockout. Up 14% from September, the union's latest proposal includes a 24% cutback in salaries for the 2004-05 season. The NHL is seeking salary caps or cost certainty. The league is expected to issue a counterproposal today.
Workers at a New York Times printing plant are raising allegations that they have been subjected to racial and religious discrimination. The lawsuit was filed by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission for workers at the paper's Addison, New Jersey plant. The lawsuit says that Hispanic, Black, and Jewish employees were denied overtime assignments, seniority rights, and promotions. They also claim that supervisors at the plant used derogatory racial and religious terms. The suit claims that the Times has long been aware of the incidents, but has done nothing to correct the behavior. The New York Times management has declined to answer reporters' questions concerning the incidents.
The state of Missouri's rapid response team is meeting with some of the 900 Ford workers facing layoff early next year at Ford's St. Louis plant. The plant's second shift is being eliminated. The rapid response team tries to help workers get transfers, new jobs, or training for new careers. These services are provided to the Ford workers free of charge. Missouri's governor worked with Ford to try and keep work at the St. Louis plant, but the second shift will be eliminated nonetheless.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Next time you drop your kid off at daycare, be sure to thank the child care workers. A new study by the Working for America Institute says that the median wage of child care workers in the U.S. is only $7.90 an hour, compared with an average of $13.53 an hour for all other jobs. Low pay, lack of benefits, and little room for advancement are causes of high turnover in the daycare industry. The study states that employers must provide workers with better wages and training for the quality of the daycare system to improve.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
We're just living our American dream. CEOs are playing for the Bush-Cheney team. My president, he got you all scared. The billionaires are coming, so you better beware.
Oh, it's the billionaires for Bush. Look out.
Parents, your daughters. Here comes the billionaire.
The billionaires are in the house.
The billionaires are in the White House. We're dining on pheasant. We're dining on sprouts. Yeah, the billionaires are in the house.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 27 minutes before the hour. Billionaires for Bush, actually, is the source of that. Chief among their targets. Yeah, I was talking about the big three automakers are cutting jobs. And meanwhile, the states are going to foreign corporations and saying, you know, we know you've got a bunch of extra dollars because everybody's shopping at Walmart and all this money is going overseas. And, well, it's not just Walmart. You know, walk into any big box store. Even the stuff in our supermarkets now. So all this money is going overseas. And you've got all these dollars. And I know that you're going to come here and, you know, build a factory, build a plant, buy some land. Hopefully employ some of our people. And please do it in our state. Chief among their targets is, quoting from Nerohiko Shirozu's article in on the front page, or I don't know if this is a front page or not. Anyhow, in today's Wall Street Journal, states are wooing foreign car makers. Chief among their targets is Toyota Motor Corp., Japan's largest automaker, which has set bold expansion plans as part of its global push to rival General Motors Corp. as the world's number one automaker. Last month, Toyota chairman Hiroshi Okuda confirmed that the company likely will open yet another North American plant, its seventh in the region, setting off a scramble in at least 10 U.S. state capitals, including Mississippi, Alabama, Kansas, Missouri, and Texas. Competitions for factories, he notes, this article notes, competitions for factories usually wind up with states offering rich packages of tax breaks and other incentives to corporations. Can you imagine if you were to call up the governor's office of the state of California or Indiana or Kentucky or any other state and say, you know,
I'm thinking of moving to your state. And I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to pay property taxes, and I'm going to pay income taxes, and I'm going to be supporting the local economy by eating at the Burger King. And, you know, I'll be there, so I'd like you to give me a tax break to come to your state. What do you think they'd say? Oh, well, if you come to our state, you won't have to pay any income taxes for the first 10 years, and property taxes will be one-third, and we'll build the road to your house, and we'll give you free water, and we'll give you a discount on electricity, and we'll make sure that your insurance needs are met, and we'll provide you with actual welfare. We'll give you money. Somehow I think not. But if you're the CEO of Toyota and you say, I'd like to bring my company to your state, they will fall all over themselves. Critics claim, notes Shirozu in this Wall Street Journal article, critics claim the incentives are a waste of taxpayer money. Art Rolnick, Director of Research at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, hardly a member of the Green Party, says, from a national point of view, this is bad economics, because all these incentives are achieving is they simply move around within the U.S., and this is one of the things that's been happening. These come, they'll park someplace for a couple of years, and then they'll say, yeah, we're thinking of moving. Boeing just recently did this. They were shopping around. They said, we're going to move our corporate headquarters. Who's going to give us breaks? I believe they ended up in Illinois. But they had three states competing for it. They're just moving from one state to another. Who gets screwed? We, the taxpayers. Who benefits? These huge corporations. U.S. governors, the Wall Street Journal notes, the U.S. governors are also competing for new investment with Canada and Mexico, which have an edge in labor and health care costs. They should have said respectively. They should have reversed the order. Mexico has an edge in labor costs. It's much cheaper for labor there. Canada has an edge in health care costs. Employers don't pay a penny for the health care of their employees. Toyota already has plants in both countries, notes the Wall Street Journal. The parade of state officials seeking FaceTime with Toyota highlights a shift in the industrial balance of power in the U.S. manufacturing sector, notes the Wall Street Journal. In what I would say this qualifies for understatement of the year. This this is a trend that goes back to really the Nixon times when we started the process of deficit spending in a big way in order to finance the Vietnam War. But it really took off under Ronald Reagan. You are seeing now the chickens of Reaganomics coming home to roost. Detroit's big three automakers, plus part suppliers Delphi Corporation and Visteon Corporation, together have shed about 80,000 hourly manufacturing jobs in the United States since 1999. General Motors, for instance, closed 95 plants and opened 34 new ones in the U.S. between 1979 and 1998. Basically, since Reagan came into office until 98. Meanwhile, Toyota and other Asian and European automakers increasingly are the ones making plans to create new jobs. Why? Because our trade policies, because we've done away with these tariffs, we've joined the World Trade Organization, we signed the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, GATT. Bill Clinton signed this idiotic piece of legislation. We signed NAFTA. There's old Ross Perot with his big ears and his signs going, see that big sucking sound in the south? Look out, it's coming to get you. He was right. 18% of Americans knew he was right. When Bill Clinton pushed NAFTA and GATT through the House and the Senate, more than 50% of Americans were opposed to it, and they don't have degrees in economics. They just have common sense. And sure enough, here we are, 6 years later, 8 years later, wondering where our jobs have gone, and with our state officials falling all over each other, to give tax breaks to big corporations so they can be more profitable. And what do you think Toyota is going to do with its profits? Do you really think that Toyota is going to take its profits and spend them in the United States? No siree, Bob. Toyota takes its profits back to Japan and distributes it to its stockholders in Japan, who then buy Japanese goods in Japan, stimulating the Japanese economy. And what are we left with? Well, a few folks got a job. Isn't that nice? Insourcing. You've got these cons on TV. They go on the Lou Dobbs show, and they talk about the wonders of insourcing. Isn't it nice that these corporations are coming to America to give us jobs? Give me a break! They are strip mining us. And they're doing it because we changed the rules of the game to not just allow it, but encourage it. Walmart is strip mining us for cheap labor. And all the other companies that are engaged in active union busting and preventing, and all these foreign companies coming, it's just... So, in Australia, now this also from today's Wall Street Journal, a much smaller story, I might note. The headline, regulators from New Zealand and Australia ask for documents. Regulators from Australia and New Zealand widened their probe of allegations of cartel-related behavior. See, they call them cartels. We call them monopolies or trusts. It's all the same thing. It's AOL, Time Warner, CNN. It's when one corporation owns a bunch of other corporations and does multiple things. It used to be against the law. Regulators from Australia and New Zealand, where it still is against the law, widened their probe of allegations of cartel-related behavior in Australia's $2 billion Australian dollar cardboard box sector. Now, $2 billion is a lot of money. It's small potatoes here in the United States. To include all three main companies, the three companies that dominate this industry, Vissi Industries, privately owned by billionaire Richard Pratt, said the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission. Oh, gee, a Competition and Consumer Commission. We have that. It used to be, it's called the Securities and Exchange Commission. But ever since Ronald Reagan, it has changed its function. It's no longer, its job is no longer to constrain and restrain great, big, huge, monolithic, monstrous, out-of-control multinational corporations from making it impossible for anybody to compete with them and to encourage the growth and development of small and medium-sized businesses in the United States. Instead, it has become a rubber stamp for mergers and acquisitions. But in Australia and New Zealand, they have a little different view of this. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission and the New Zealand Commerce Commission have asked for unspecified documents to help investigations. Melbourne-based Vissi and Amcor Limited each hold at least 45% of Australia's cardboard box market. The Australian Competition and the end of quote. This is from the Dow Jones Newswire. So what we have here is the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission and the New Zealand Commerce Commission don't think this is good for their countries. They don't think it's good for entrepreneurs who might want to get into the business. They don't think it's healthy for business. And they are right. What a surprise. They are absolutely right. One of the ways that we used to deal with one of the twin problems that's driving this thing is this trade deficit, the fact that we are importing more than we are exporting. One of the reasons we're importing more than we're exporting is because we no longer protect domestic industries. We used to say if you want to, you know, if there's a dollar's worth of labor in a T-shirt made in South Carolina in one of the textile mills, or not, let's say a dress shirt, there's a dollar's worth of labor in that, and you want to make them in Malaysia where that labor is going to only cost 50 cents or 10 cents, then when you import that shirt into the United States, you have to pay a 90-cent tax. It's called a tariff, an import tax, a tariff or a duty on it. So that whether you make it here or whether you make it in Malaysia, the labor cost is going to be a buck. You don't prevent people from going overseas and doing business. That would be un-American. What you do is you organize the rules of the game in such a way that the businesses in America who are doing business in America have a financial incentive to keep their business here, to keep their manufacturing here, to keep their purchasing here. Very simple and straightforward. Very simple and straightforward. And you do it with quotas and tariffs. Now, understanding as you do that this is how you maintain a healthy economy, consider the media bias in this story that appeared in the Dallas Morning News. And I don't know if this is because the reporters are just ignorant of economics and how the world works, or if they are cheerleaders for this stuff. But just get this. This article, quotas on apparel, textiles dying. Article by Catherine Young and Maria Halkias in the Dallas Morning News, yesterday's paper. The day before yesterday, Sunday, December 12th. Dateline Dallas. On New Year's Eve, U.S. consumers will have an extra reason to toast the arrival of 2005 better and less expensive clothes. The World Trade Organization's 148 member nations will lift all quotas on apparel and textiles January 1st. Yes, you can toast the fact that you will now be able to buy on an unlimited basis clothing made in nations where labor is incredibly cheap. The cost of that T-shirt might go down 5 cents. The cost of that dress shirt might go down 50 cents. And, by the way, you don't have a job anymore! The changes, in fact, they note, will bring their share of pain. Nearly 700,000 people work in the U.S. textile industry. That's down from millions before Reagan got into this. Many could lose their, not just Reagan. Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush. This is where the Democratic Leadership Council is so toxic. These guys, they want the Democratic Party to be Republican light. Oh, free trade, it's a wonderful thing. It's a shame you can't outsource the DLC, right? Let's take all these guys. I mean, after all, they're just sitting around coming up with rationalizations and theories. There's people in India who know how to do that. Let's reinvent. Let's move all those jobs to India. Let's move the DLC to India. The changes will bring their share of pain. Yuang and Halkias in this Dallas Morning News article. Nearly 700,000 people work in the U.S. textile industry. Many could lose their jobs, including more in South Carolina. Eric Autour, Vice President and International Trade Council at the National Retail Federation. Now, these are the folks who are in love with this, because what it means is that retail stores, from Walmarts to Macy's, are going to be able to buy their stuff cheaper so they can make more profit. They like this. So he says there's going to be winners and losers in this reshuffle. He's going to be the winner. And the losers? The workers of America. That's all, just the workers of America. Without trade restrictions, Penny expects its cost to fall between 8 and 18% over 2 years. Depending on the price of raw materials, apparel companies will be able to concentrate production in the most efficient markets. Isn't that sweet? In other words, no more American jobs. 10 minutes before the hour.
Bonjour, my name is Michel, and I founded the Organic Wine Company with my sister 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines yet, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious that when turned into wine, you can really taste the difference. Our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it very easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you three of my favorite organic French wines at half their regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. C'est magnifique! And if you don't agree, I will gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, which is ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
This is a WIN feature story. I'm Sarah Turner. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg recently reduced by one the number of firefighters on engine companies. WIN reporter Leanne Caldwell has more.
New York City Fire Commissioner Nicholas Scapetta accepted a decision by Mayor Michael Bloomberg to reduce staff at 49 engine companies from 5 crew members to 4 because of a rise in medical leave. The move leaves only 11 of the 197 engine companies with a 5-person crew.
The priority of saving lives and safety should and must come first over penny pinching.
Uniform Firefighters Association spokesperson Tom Butler says the decision risks the safety of both firefighters and fire victims.
It's just a fact that less firefighters on a crew means it takes longer to actually fight a fire.
The decision to reduce staff size excuses the city from shifting around staff to cover posts and paying overtime at a time that the medical leave of firefighters has risen above 7.5%. The move will save the city about $1.4 million a month in overtime pay. The decision stems from a 1996 agreement between former president of the UFA, Tom Von Essen, and then Mayor Rudy Giuliani, that if medical leave rises above 7.5%, the mayor has the authority to cut staff. At a union meeting this week, delegates from the UFA unanimously voted no confidence about New York Fire Commissioner Nicholas Scapetta. The vote is only symbolic. Commissioner Scapetta called the vote pure politics. Mayor Bloomberg backed the commissioner and blamed firefighters for poor behavior, including sex, drugs, drinking, and fighting on the job. This is the latest dispute between the city and the union. The city has closed 5 ladder units in the past 2 years to accommodate changing needs of the city, but at the objection of the union, which says all ladder companies are needed. And the city and the union have been unable to agree on a contract for 2.5 years. For WIN, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It ain't no use to sit and wonder why, babe. It don't matter anyhow.
And welcome back. In our chat room, I just learned that tonight on CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which living here in the People's Republic of Vermont is actually one of the stations, one of the channels that's on our
on our local cable system. A lot of folks with a good antenna can pick it up even. I'm just a two-hour drive from Montreal here. There's going to be a program, The Unauthorized Biography of Dick Cheney. Tonight, Tuesday, December 14th, that's today, at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on CBC News World. That should be interesting. If you go to cbc.ca/fifth, F-I-F-T-H, you can get the whole thing. I saw their unauthorized biography of Don Rumsfeld back in October. Scared the bejesus out of me. So we'll be sure to be watching that tonight. I'll report on it here tomorrow. It should be interesting. The things I learned in our chat room, and we've also been discussing when is Dick Cheney going to step down so the heir apparent can take over. My prediction is that it will be after the midterm elections. Dick Cheney will stick around until the elections of 2006 are over, and then in January 2007, he's going to discover that he wants to spend more time with his family in Wyoming. And he will be replaced by either Jeb Bush, Chuck Hagel, or somebody else. Those are my two leading candidates who will be vice president, thus providing a launching pad for the presidential candidacy of the Republican in 2008. So maybe this will go into the archives, and we'll see if I'm a fool or if I'm right. China, by the way, just to wrap this thing up on these export duties and all this stuff, now that the World Trade Organization is saying after January 1st there's no more duties, no more export, no more limits on exports, and China can just inhale the market. China constitutes 50% of clothing exports into the United States. 17% of the world's textiles and clothes in 2003 were made by China. And by 2007, they're estimating it'll be 50% of the world's stuff. So China has stepped in and is voluntarily putting their own export duties. In other words, they're going to tax exports going out of China if other countries aren't going to tax imports. Now, one, this helps the Chinese economy. It's more money for the Chinese government. Two, it slows down. It softens the blow. So they can make this gradual change so that people in other countries won't suddenly see millions of jobs vanish in 1 month and get it that they're being screwed by the WTO and the Chinese. And so they'll gradually phase this in over a year or so at their own rate. It's a brilliant political move on the part of the Chinese. It's also in today's Wall Street Journal. All you have to do is read the paper, the rich folks talking to each other, and you get it. What's going on? No secrets. It's amazing. Thanks to Louise for producing our program today, to Ira Gravatt for engineering it, to Brad for our music, to Shelby for streaming us around the planet at radiopower.org, the folks in our chat room, to Jay for our music, to Ben for the archives, and to you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug? The phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartman Show.